So, I realize that I didn't know exactly what your marital status is at the moment, even though I know you. Are you officially single now or semi-officially single?
I'm single.
Yeah.
In the sense of not being married, if you know what I mean. I can do anything I like to anyone I like. with their consent.
Well, it's a long show, and...
I'm single.
I was thinking sometime you ought to really write a serious book on women and marriage, because you've been through, how many, two...
I was married two times.
Two full times.
Once and then once again.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever... do you think when you've been married twice that you caught on to the first marriage what would make a second marriage work? Do you know what I mean? And then is it a shock when you find that the thing you thought you learned from the first marriage doesn't work in the second marriage?
Right, because you apply everything that you learned in the first marriage to the second girl. And that's a problem, because the second girl is nothing like the first girl if you're lucky. And that's exactly what I did. I made a certain amount of mistakes in my first marriage, like showing up, you know. And because of it, I tried to learn from those mistakes and gain a certain wisdom. And in my second marriage, I applied these little nuances and tricks and little moves and things that I was able to accumulate over the years. And that marriage lasted shorter than my first marriage.
So there's just no way to know. Now, would you take a third one, a third dive?
From who?
Third chance? No, would you take a chance on a third marriage?
I would marry again, I think, if the opportunity presented itself in a way that enabled me to feel that there was a chance of it succeeding.
Yeah. But is there
this is not a proposal, is it?
No. It's a long show, however. Is there a type that you look for? Do you have a certain set of characteristics that you see? Ah, there goes Miss Wright.
Yeah, but, you know, you'll hate me if I say it. I like pretty girls. You know, I'm old-fashioned that way. I like girls that are pretty and earthy-looking. You know, almost... broad. I'd rather she was overweight than underweight, and long hair, and straggly, earth mother, sexual kind of animal, disgusting types. You know, that's right. You really see them there with the blouse and you know, dirty and everything, and I enjoy that because the thought of what you could do with them later is wonderful. You know what I mean? I like them to be intelligent and have a good sense of humor, to anticipate my needs, and be aggressive without being masculine. I like a girl who will perform any act without any problem, and a girl that doesn't like to cook and doesn't like to do home things, and a girl, her religious convictions don't matter whatsoever, and just about anybody.
Yeah. Would you ever go on a blind date?
I would not go on a blind date because I used to go on blind dates, and they were not successful for me for the most part. The trouble with a blind date is the anticipation of the girl that you're going to get on the date never comes out to be what you actually wind up with.
You
have wonderful thoughts of you'll open the door and this girl will be there and she'll be sensational. Then you meet her, you know, and she's like playing with a rubber tire hanging from a chain in the living room. You know, it's depressing, and everybody goes through the same thing because you can't. There's no way to beat that blind date thing because what you build up when you hear you have a blind date and they say the girl's name is like Gloria or something. I said Gloria at random because I don't know any Glorias, and you think you're going to get a real package of wonderfulness. They sound great over the phone and everything, and there's no way the girl can live up to it. Also, there's no way you can live up to her expectation. I have a dread of knocking on the door on a blind date and the girl opening the door and looking at me. And her face falling, you know, and, you know, that look where she says, or when I was younger, they used to look at me and they'd say, oh, come in, you know, forcing a smile on their face. And I would sit down and they would run back in their bedroom and take their heels off and put on flats.
Oh, yes. I used to get that.
Sure, because they used to tower over me on those.
Oh, I hated that.
Context of White Supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, August 19, 2021. So I have been told. This is our weekly book club session number 3, Woody Allen's Apropos of Nothing. I will say this is one of the book clubs that I am most proud of, to this segment specifically, because I had computer problems this week and I had to mail my computer to good old Ron DeSantis land down in Florida, retired firefighter and others down there. Had to mail my computer off for repairs, and I had the Woody Allen audiobook on the hard drive on the computer that I mailed off for repairs. So I was all concerned because I didn't have a chance to copy my hard drive before I mailed it off and get the audiobook to my other computer so that I continue rolling. So I was a little concerned, a little nervous. Didn't know, you know, how I was going to be able to get the book club together, but persevered, and we are rolling nonetheless, even with the same audio, Woody Allen narrating his own work. Whew, counter-racist grind. The audio segment that we heard at the beginning, that was from 1971, The Dick Cavett Show with the author Woody Allen, about a half century ago, if you can, you know, factor it all that in. But I thought that was so important. They spend all this time talking about, you know, who is your Miss Right? You know, who is the one for you? And even though this is 50 years ago, Woody Allen at that time was not like a teeny bopper. He was not in his 20s. He was in his 30s at the time of that interview that we heard. And in fact, Soon Yi was 1 year old at the time of that interview. In addition, now keep all that together. Now, did you hear in the interview? And he says, well, I like a girl. I think we've had other folks, Ivy and some other folks who said, hey, man, something about this system of white supremacy. We got all these Jerry Sandusky's and Jeffrey Epstein and Harvey Weinstein and all these folks that are around here raping these young girls and all the rest of it. Like, why are we saying girlfriend and boyfriend? If I am attempting to be a man, a woman, an adult, I'm not talking to a girl. I don't have a boyfriend. I would have a care mate, partner, a male friend, a man friend, a woman friend, not a girlfriend. For him to continue, girl, girl, girl. And then did you hear the part where he said, well, what types of things do you like in a girl? And he says, oh, well, I like a girl who's down to do anything, any act that I want without a shred of, you know, shame or disgrace about it. And I thought, oh, my goodness. Do you remember last week we were talking about some of his different movies and things, Mighty Aphrodite, and he talked about one of the female characters as a porn star and all this other sexual deviance, even in, is it Manhattan? I'm not a Woody Allen film buff, but I think it's Manhattan, where he has the scene with the young lady who I believe is 17 and he's like 42. And they're in bed together, and she says, well, hey, let's do it again. And maybe you can think of a position that you've never done it before. All of these reference to some sort of sexual deviance with a girl, coming from someone who is 35 years old, 40 years old, 50s in his 80s now. So, I mean, Woody Allen, my man, Mo in Dallas, he says, Woody, did he name himself after an erection? Let's get to old Woody Allen, Apropos of Nothing. This is audio segment one.
Harlene did fly out and we married. The words "I do" sounded to me like they were spoken in a cavernous echo chamber, like Orson Welles' lips saying "Rosebud." It took place, however, in some rabbi's living room, a nod to her parents, and I could imagine a vault door closing on my life, a crypt door. Yes, I loved Harlene, but I had no idea what love meant, what to expect, what not to expect, what was required. What followed was a nightmare for both of us, but it was my fault. Inexperienced as she was up for it and was a larger person, had better personal resources. I failed at it so miserably and made her life miserable in the process. I'll paint the picture for you, and it's a sad picture. We both survived it, but let me take you back to those years of early marital agony. two very young people. She's on the verge of starting college. I'm earning enough to support us. The writer development program starts to fray, its ranks thinning as the duds get weeded out. We return to New York as the Colgate Comedy Hour quietly succumbs. We take an apartment, Park Avenue and 61st Street. Naturally, I gravitate instantly to the Upper East Side, all those penthouse movies. Except we don't live in a penthouse. It's a very small one-room apartment, and I mean one room. The tiny rectangle cost me $125 per month, and since neither of us was experienced, it didn't occur to us that being the first apartment in a multiple-dwelling brownstone and contiguous to the building's front door, which had all the doorbells on a panel, that every time someone enters and rings, the ringback, a loud electric buzz, reverberates throughout our apartment like an Evinrude. In our one small room, we have a sofa bed, a kitchen table with four chairs, a bookcase, a television set, a piano, a comfy chair facing the sofa bed, a few lamps, and a stand with a large tape recorder. My typewriter is on the kitchen table because it's where I work. I'd love to say we were cramped in a Fibber McGee's closet, poor but happy, and didn't we have fun in those days? We did not. On the plus side, I was putting Harlene through college. She went to Hunter, just 6 blocks away, and I walked her to school every morning before digging into work. I was so glad when she was gone because there was not a single thing we could agree on, not a single compromise either of us was capable of making, and we battled like hitmen in the Castellamarese War. I was moody, unhappy, nasty to her very nice parents for no reason other than I was an obnoxious swine. I couldn't stand my wife's friends. I got on her nerves with my constant sullen unhappiness. I began getting nauseated often, usually in the dead of night. I attributed it either to a fatal disease or her cooking, but my yearly physical had me in good health, and the middle of the night nausea set in even if we ate out. When I think back how precarious it was, 3 a.m., I rise with unbearable queasiness. We call an emergency service, which sends one of those anonymous freelance doctors on duty all night. A stranger comes. He injects me. The nausea abates. I sleep. This routine happens often. It was not until I entered psychoanalysis as a last resort to my unending misery that the nausea was diagnosed as psychological, and in no time after entering analysis, I became completely cured of the attacks. If couch psychoanalysis did nothing for me but that, and it didn't, it would have been worth it. Somewhere in this time frame, a letter arrived in the mail. I sensed it might be that offer from Bob Hope, which had never materialized. A letter from an unknown source is an exciting thing, and I couldn't wait to open it. As it turned out, it was a draft notice. Well, you can imagine my surprise and how thrilled I was. Finally, a chance to live in a men's barracks, to shower with 24 strange males, to share a bathroom with guys called Alabama and Texas, and I'd be Brooklyn, to snap awake at 5:30, drill all day, take orders from a buzz-cut Neanderthal with a plank-length brain. And the food, free at last from a diet of New York sirloin, lobster, the burgers at 21, and my Reuben special. It would no longer be General So's chicken, but General MacArthur's chicken. Or what is that they serve in the Army on a shingle? Naturally, I longed to see action, to sit cramped and seasick as my landing barge rocked ashore, and I hit the beach against the volley of enemy machine guns, the wounds, the hospital, Harold Russell. Here was my chance to be a hero, a Medal of Honor winner, proud to serve. I quickly contacted every physician I knew and begged for notes, claiming I was physically handicapped. On the day of my examination, I showed up with a wheelbarrow of alibis, declaring me a crippled specimen and prescribing bed rest. Flat feet, asthma, poor eyesight, gallbladder, allergies, curvature of the spine, hiatal hernia, torn rotator cuff, frozen shoulder, vertigo, Alice in Wonderland syndrome. All stamped by the examining doctors, no evidence. Down to my final interview with the psychiatrist, where I brought notes certifying my psychopathology from my shrink to the last cab driver I had. The situation looked like it was a sure 1A. The examining doctor told me to hold out my hand. I did. And it was steady, not trembling. Then he asked, "Do you always bite your nails?" I was not a severe nail biter, but I confessed it was a habit of mine. He perused my fingertips and abruptly stamped me 4F. Rejected by the army because I was a nail biter. Was it a first? And so lucky for the other soldiers who would have been in my barracks. Now they wouldn't have to bunk next to a guy who sobs himself to sleep clutching a small cloth bear. I have since, at my wife's insistence, given up nail biting, replacing that disgusting habit with the more socially acceptable coprolalia. The grim days of unhappy wedlock drifted on. Winter passed, and with the exception of a deafening crash that woke us up in the middle of the night, nothing eventful happened. The horrible noise came from a man in 525 Park, a large apartment house next door, who had jumped to his death and landed in a small alley between his building and ours. Hopefully, you'll never hear a suicide hit the pavement, but take it from me, it's much louder than you think. Summer came, and now we will take a moment to talk about Tamarind. This was a summer resort in Pennsylvania which had a theater and a theatrical company who put on highly professional reviews every week. Costumes, dancers, singers, sketches, production numbers. The original Once Upon a Mattress was done up there by the summer theater people. Max Liebman, Danny and Doc Simon, Sid Caesar, Mel Brooks, Joe Layton, Danny Kaye. They were all veterans. It was a cornucopia of incipient talent. Comedy writers, songwriters, directors, costume and set designers all began there and went on to big careers. There was a full orchestra with fantastic musicians and crackerjack arrangers. Danny Simon urged me to spend a few summers there, as he and Doc had. He felt the constant pressure to turn out a sketch or two every week that would immediately go into rehearsal and play for better or worse Saturday and Sunday nights was the learning experience of a lifetime. Seeing material done live, seeing how audiences responded, a life-and-death situation every week for 10 weeks. And the cherry on the cake was that, as the summer passes, I would accumulate playable sketches that could be done in a Broadway review. Ever since I moved to New York, someone or other was always trying to get a review produced on Broadway. New Faces had been a big hit, and everyone in town with a song or a skit in his trunk wanted to have a review. Eager and talented young people would meet with a gung-ho producer in one or another Upper West Side apartment and pound out satirical songs on the piano and love songs, and the comedy writers would read their sketches to the hilarity of the others, and blood oaths were sworn to get a review on. By God, this time we will. I know a backer from Texas, from Florida, an Argentine who's crazy about American theater. Almost none ever saw the light of day. The few that did usually died the death of a dog. I supplied 3 sketches for an ill-fated infliction called From A to Z, starring Hermione Gingold. All 3 sketches had crippled the audiences at Tamarind. The first was a sketch about 2 guys who go to a party and all the girls are replicas of Groucho Marx. The sketch did not amuse the commercial Broadway critics, though Ken Tynan, writing for The New Yorker, found it hilarious. The second was a thing called psychological warfare, in which soldiers clashing on a battlefield fought psychologically. You're too short. You're too short. Your mother never loved you. You get the idea. It played quite well. The third involved a general at Cape Canaveral phoning the mayor of New York to prepare him for the fact that a nuclear missile they were testing had misfired and was headed toward his city. So here's why I'm calling, Mr. Mayor, and try not to be a baby about it. Anyhow, the Groucho sketch and psychological warfare made it from out of town into the opening. The missile toward New York sketch, which convulsed them at Tamarind, couldn't wrench a smile from a single seat holder. Don't know why. The only thing I could think of was that the show was previewing in Connecticut and Philadelphia, and perhaps the audience didn't find the predicament comic because New York wasn't their town. You never know why they don't laugh at stuff you think they should love. It's not an exact science. So Harlan and I spent the summer at Tamarind, where I wrote sketches that played well. The other sketch writer was David Panish, an odd and brilliant character whom I owe much to. He was 10 years older than me, dazzlingly brilliant, immense erudition, could draw with the precision of Dürer or Dali. He wrote poetry. He read everything, and he played boogie-woogie on the piano. He hated modern jazz, but had lived among all the great modern giants, Monk, Miles, and had a romance with Charlie Parker's wife. He was a gifted sculptor who carved the famous carving on Charlie Mingus's bass. His apartment on Roosevelt Island was like entering a spaceship. Ultra-modern, his own paintings on the wall, always morbid subject matter like his poetry. He earned his money as a schoolteacher in Harlem and was quite racist about blacks. And yet all his students loved him, and he took them to museums and restaurants, always on his own dime, and to his house. He imitated them offensively. He had been in a mental institution in a straitjacket, and he fascinated me with tales of how terrible it was when they'd come to knock him out with electricity for his shock treatments, which was the crude way they did it then. He had spent time walking over the George Washington Bridge and contemplated jumping. He had gone to the roof of his apartment house to spit down on people. His only distant relatives in New York had him committed. At first he agreed, then panicked as the attendants marched him down a long corridor. He got violent, the straitjacket, the shock treatments, and all because of a woman, an affair with one he thought was perfect and who dumped him for another woman after some time together. In an era before marijuana became a middle-class cliché, he was high a lot. His connection was a black woman named Hazel in Harlem. He risked much in those days, jail and his teacher's license. He was a user, not a dealer, but being high made him laugh easily. And he was a great audience for me. He opened my eyes to just how great S.J. Perelman was, superior to all other funny minds, an axiom I hold to this day. He made me improve my vocabulary. Often we discussed women. He worshipped them, but did not like them. I was an unhappily married young man trying to make it work. "Call it quits," he counseled me, sucking deeply on his reefer while we sat together by the lake of Camp Tamamint, schmoozing on those late afternoons. "And dump that excuse for a manager who's an embarrassment to you. He's a fish peddler, not to mention he's robbing you blind." Harvey had no office, just an answering service. He would go up to all the agents' offices and say, "Any work? Any rags, any bones, any bottles today?" Then he would use their phones, honeymooners, two very different great comedians, Sid and Jackie Gleason. Sid had a cerebral band of writers, Mel Brooks, Larry Gelbart, Mel Tolkien, Lucille Callan, Mike Stewart, Shelley Keller, Neil Simon, not to mention contributors like Carl Reiner, Howie Morris, and Sid himself. Sid's brilliant weekly show was the cynosure of all who dealt or appreciated smart comedy. To get on his staff alongside those names was a true prize. Sid was a genius, a flamboyant one, and his material was brilliantly written and brilliantly executed. I had another strong year at Tamamint. Milt Kamen returned to work as Caesar's stand-in and raved to Sid about me. Sid had already heard my name from Danny Simon. He agreed to meet with me. I went up to his office, and he sat at a desk along with Larry Gelbart. Gelbart was 10 years older than me, around 30. We all spoke for a while about politics, sports, life, and it seemed like nothing much was happening. As the clock hit around 6 and both men planned to go home, Sid turned to me in that grandiose way he had and said, "And you? You're hired." I rode down with Gelbart and I said, "I'm hired?" And he said, "If you'll work for the minimum." "I'll pay the minimum to be in a room with you two guys," I said. Larry Gelbart, by the age of 30, was already a veteran and a legend. His father was a barber who pushed his son's gags on a captive audience of stars whose hair he cut. Larry had written radio, Duffy's Tavern, for Danny Kaye, for Burl, for Bob Hope, and now for Caesar. When he died, I was asked for a comment, and I said, "He was one of the only people in my life who lived up to the hype. He was a fabulous guy and a truly great comedy writer. A Jewish writer the way Mailer was a Jewish writer. That is, they were both Jews, but you never saw it in their work." Together, Larry and I clicked, and the show we wrote won a Peabody Award. We satirized Ingmar Bergman and Tennessee Williams, and we also won some kind of Writers Guild thing, and there was a lunch to honor the winners at Toot Shores, and I walked up to the door but couldn't enter. A phobia I wrestle with to this day, entering phobia. I once sat outside Sidney Lumet's lovely townhouse on Lexington Avenue while all the dinner guests arrived, and I was to be among them, and I couldn't enter. And I sat and tried to get up the courage, and I saw ones I knew and liked and who liked me. Bob Fosse, Milos Forman, Patty Chayefsky. But I couldn't bring myself to enter. When I had to go to an event, I made sure I was the first one there, so maybe then I could enter. I was invited by President Johnson to the White House once. I left my apartment, flew to D.C., changed in the airport bathroom into a tux, raced to the White House to be the first one and not have to miss this opportunity. I entered, but I was beaten by Richard Rogers, whom I had never met. But he threw his arms around me and said, if our grandparents could see us. He had his little quirks, too, and I wondered if entering phobia was among them. Incidentally, years later, I did attend a crowded party at Sidney Lumet's and somehow entered, and I was sitting on the sofa, which backed against a wall of windows. The social ramble, as Satchel Paige called it, was getting too much for me, and when a famous lady singer was urged to perform, I got ultra antsy. As someone sat down at the piano and began to play a song she was associated with, I longed for nothing more in the world but to be out of there. Why? Who knows? I only know hot flashes crippled me with discomfort. The hitch was I was quite far from the front door and couldn't gracefully push my way through the people and split as the guest had started her number. I did not want to be accused of boorishness. Then it hit me. The window right behind me was half open. Lumet lived in a townhouse, so I was on the ground floor. Everyone's attention was focused on the piano. I was behind the ecstatic revelers, and with a bit of choreography, I could slip out the window and onto 91st Street, and who would be the wiser? I quickly slid the window up a bit more so I could ease through. The one thing I did not want is for anyone to turn and catch me in mid-escape. Quietly, I began my exit. The singer sang. I eased, one leg at a time to be precise. Suddenly, it occurred to me that if I was spotted by pedestrians on the street climbing out the window, I could look like a burglar. What if, God forbid, a rookie cop sees me and takes a shot at me? Panic set in, and I manipulated my way back in and onto the sofa. I sat through the singing, leaving when everyone else did. But you can see how much my psychoanalysis was helping me, although I had had only about 23 years of it when I did this. So I finished Hammermint, got hired by Sid Caesar, and then again by Sid for a special, this time with Mel Brooks, who I'd heard was an energetic terror and would eat me alive. But he was also a terrific guy, and he liked me, and we'd walk home together every night. He regaled me with his romantic adventures, and I marveled at how such a small Jew could mesmerize one magnificent woman after another. Mel was bright, well-read, and musically talented. Writing for Sid amounted to a group of guys meeting in a room about 10 o'clock each morning. Lots of chat about movies, current events, general small talk, eventually getting out to actually trying to write something. Everyone would pitch ideas, and when one was agreed upon, we'd all go at it, throwing lines, laughing at each other's lines, or shooting down the ones we didn't like. Writing with only one other person, like Larry Gelbart or Danny Simon, was really the same procedure, except two guys went through the opening small talk before settling to work. Later, when I collaborated with Mickey Rose or Marshall Brickman or Doug McGrath, it was also pretty much the same with the added element that we were personal friends and we would take walks and have dinner together while we continued to develop the screenplay. Lunch with Sid was always fun, since the writers were funny. If we went out rather than ordering in, Sid would never let anyone grab a check. I ate alone with him once and snatched the check and insisted, and he only let me take it after examining it closely and making sure it wasn't a big number. I saw him allow Larry Gelbart to pick up a check once, and I could see that it killed him, and I heard him say when he reluctantly permitted it, "I've finally grown up." Whenever Danny Simon or Gelbart needed a collaborator, I got the call. Two different personalities. Danny, so secretive, would call and say, "Can't talk about it on the phone. Meet me at Hanson's." I'd say, "Is it a writing job or do I have to pass microfilm?" He got me on the Paul Winchell show. Winchell was a great ventriloquist, so I was writing for a piece of wood. Larry Gelbart would call, "Will you collaborate with me in a special for Art Carney?" "Sure. Come up to my farm. You and your wife can sleep over. We start today." Once when I was writing for Sid, he, I, and Larry were at Sid's house in Great Neck. Sid decided we'd do all our writing in the steam room. Even though I was new on the job and loved them both, I wouldn't get naked and sit in the steam room with two guys. They both spent the next hour in there while I sat outside on the lawn. Sid always found me a little weird, but liked me. Over the years, I had lots of good times with Larry. Dinners, walks, shopping in London, exchanging jokes in Paris, listening to jazz in Manhattan clubs. He treated me as an equal. Whereas to Danny, I was always that kid who he discovered in California. The contract with Harvey Meltzer ran out. I did not re-up. I had heard of a manager who everyone wanted to be handled by, but who was very picky. He had discovered and made Harry Belafonte. When Belafonte was an unknown, he said he was destined one day to be a limitless star, clubs, cabarets, and on film. Skeptics scoffed at the notion of a black calypso singer going so far. But Jack Rollins had a vision. They scoffed also at two kids from Chicago doing intellectual improvisations, but Jack said there were going to be big stars, and Nichols and Ray exploded on the scene. He handled only a few people, feeling he couldn't do a good job for his clients unless he kept their number down. His commission was 15%, and that was it. A mutual friend introduced me to him. He had never handled a writer before, but when he read my material, he liked it. When I told Jack and his partner, Charlie Jaffe, that ever since I saw Mort Saul, I harbored a gnawing urge to be a comedian, Jack asked, "Doing what kind of stuff?" I said, "Well, I've been toying with this notion that the New York Times is the only paper with no comic strip. And what if I had one and was like Superman, but when he changed his clothes, he changed into a Wall Street broker?" From that moment on, Jack would not let me get out of becoming a comic, no matter how hard I tried. I agreed to 15%, a fortune less than what I was paying Harvey, and got a brilliant manager in the bargain. We shook hands, never signing any papers, and remained together till he died at 100. He was one of the few people, maybe the only person I knew, who had actual wisdom. He wasn't just smart and a visionary when it came to talent. Wisdom is different, and try as I did to combat his wisdom with my rationalization, fears, prejudices, and cockeyed notions, he prevailed enough to make a gigantic contribution to my career. But at first, I fought him. I thought I knew it all when it came to comedy. I had been practically a child prodigy and a success, much appreciated by the finest comedy writers in the business. At 22, I was made head writer of the Pat Boone TV show. I lost that job because I wasn't the right fit, but Pat was yet another very nice man to work for. I was giving him sketches you needed Sid Caesar to pull off. I wound up a writer on the Gary Moore show and lost that job playing hooky. I had a good reputation as a writer, especially with the other good writers in town who asked for me on shows, and I kept working. But I had whetted Jack Rollins' appetite to discover a new comedian, and it became clear he had faith in me pursuing that job, even though I did not. Days I worked on TV making lots of money. In my spare time, I was putting together an act just to see if it looked like anything. And now I pause to tell you what made me think of leaving the isolation of the writer's room and taking a shot at going on stage to be a stand-up comedian. Some few years back, when I was still in the NBC Writer Development Program, Les Kolodny, who headed that program, suggested I hop over to the Blue Angel and catch this upcoming comic, Mort Saul. The Blue Angel was a chic, expensive joint, and NBC would pick up the tab. I grabbed my fiancée, Harlene, put on a tie, and went over there with her. To say that I was blown away by Mort Saul, it would be like when I first tasted spare ribs. Now, when it comes to Mort, I could go on and make this book longer than War and Peace. I can't do justice to his work as a comedian. I can only say what a sports writer said to me as he extolled Babe Ruth. You had to be there. In a short time, Mort would electrify America. get booked at every college campus in the country, draw huge audiences, conquer every smart nightclub, get put on the cover of Time magazine, get profiled in the New Yorker. And those of us who were around when it was happening know we shared a comic experience like no other. It's hard to go into what made him great because the answer is everything, and no amount of prose can nail it. Suffice it to say, he ruined my life in the way that Charlie Parker ruined every saxophone player who came after him for years. As one critic who liked me a lot wrote, if Woody Allen can lose those Mort Saul mannerisms, he could be a very funny comedian. I wanted to do what he did. I wanted to be like him. I wanted to be him. And that's the problem. You have to be him to get that effect. It wasn't the brilliant jokes, which were the best I ever heard. It was the man. It took me a long time to understand that and to grasp that no matter how hard I tried or how clever I could make my act, I wasn't him. It's the same problem 99% of the actors had after Brando hit the scene. They walked like him, paused like him, posed like him, postured and pivoted like him. But in the end, they were them. In the end, I was always me. As Marshall Brickman so incisively put it in a discussion about art and artists, you're fucked by who you are. I did extremely well as a stand-up comedian, but what I did when compared to Mort was second rate. I had worked up a routine and did it for Jack Rollins, Charlie Jaffe, and Jack's wife, Jane. They found me funny. Everyone except me thought I was a natural comedian. Jack wanted me to test the waters at the Blue Angel. The Blue Angel was the hottest little club in America. As I said, it was very she-she, very sophisticated. Example, one of their acts was John Carradine reading Shakespeare. Mort and Mike and Elaine, Jonathan Winters had played there. The club had a policy on Sunday nights after the show of spotlighting a new act. It could be a singer or a comic. I had terminal stage fright, but Jack would not take no for an answer when I tried to back out. After Shelley Berman, the star and a very successful comedian, did his show to a packed house one Sunday night, he asked the audience to stay and gave me the nicest, most helpful introduction a star could give a beginner. I mounted the stage, a mass of terrors, and began. And the laughter came back so strong that Jack Rollins told me I went right into my shell. I had a half hour, and when it was over, I was backstage being criticized by Jack, a ritual that would be repeated many times over the next few years. Despite my retreating on stage, becoming shy in the face of loud laughter and applause, I must have done well because the next day offers came in. Club owners who had seen me wanted me, so did TV producers who were present that night. Jack turned them all down and said I was nowhere near ready. Now the real work would begin. He wanted me to perform over and over, month after month, until being on stage was baked into me. The writer in me suggested I could just go out and read my material. The jokes are strong. What's the difference? Jack explained patiently, if they like the man, that's it. If they connect with you, they will like your jokes. If they don't, the best gags in the world won't get you there. I disagreed. I disagreed with the unquestioning confidence of the truly ignorant. I balked at every sensible and correct thing he said, but he was patient and insistent and said if I just shut up and did what he told me and then looked up in 2 years, we could reassess and see who was right. You can be a very successful comedian, he told me, but I couldn't see it. Still, I liked him so much that I agreed to shut up and let him run things. So, that's how I wound up leaving a television writing career that paid me thousands a week to accept a no-salary job at a place called Upstairs at the Duplex for a lovely lady named Jan Wolman. Every night I cabbed to Sheridan Square along with Jack Rollins or Charlie Jaffe, usually both, and the two men, along with Jan Wolman, would pull and push me out on stage where I might work to 40 people or 10 people, depending on the weather. Another comic on the bill was a funny guy named Gary Marshall, who went on to produce Happy Days, a huge TV hit, and also to direct movies like Pretty Woman. I can tell you, he was a funny stand-up comic, too. I usually did well, but some nights were clinkers. People dropped down to see me and encouraged me. David Panish marveled at my delightful invaginations. Mel Brooks came, so did Phil Foster, the very funny Broadway comedian. Jack and Charlie never missed a show. The night Charlie got married, he and his wife hurried down to this little dive I was doing my routines at, his bride fresh from the vows in her wedding dress. Each night after the show, off to the stage delicatessen to talk about it with Jack, to hear why some of my references were too obscure, too inside. Too high-pitched, so only dogs can hear them, Jack would say. Comics would come by the table, sit down, chat. Jackie Leonard, Buddy Hackett, Henny Youngman, Gene Bayless. They were all funny, and they liked me and rooted for me because I was polite and respectful and was not a new comic disdainful of the older Boar Circuit comics. Quite the opposite. I loved their acts and let them know it. They were paternal in a way. I once wasn't sure whether to tip a Kochek girl for lending me a tie. In those days, a big tip was a buck, and it wasn't the money. I just wasn't sure of the protocol. I asked Phil Foster, "Do I tip her?" He said, "You got $10? I said, "Yeah." "Give me it," he said. I did. He tipped her the Tensky. "My God," I said, $10? I never tipped any Kochek girl $10. "You'll always remember this moment," he said, "and you'll always remember to tip. If she lends you a tie, a jacket, you tip. Now you'll remember." Incidentally, it was not that I was a cheapskate when it came to tipping. I just didn't grasp the finer points and once tipped a process server who knocked on my door and handed me a summons. In those days, the stage delicatessen on 7th Avenue was a late-night ritual. Next to the stage was the Dawn Patrol barbershop, open 24 hours, and you could get a haircut or a shave at 3 o'clock in the morning. Also open all night was the Colony Record Shop, where one could browse and pick up girls during the wee hours. Then there was the Larry Matthews Beauty Salon, where guys would also pick up girls. And what girls? All the beautiful showgirls and chorus girls went there when the nightclubs closed to be made even more beautiful. I never was good at picking up chorus girls and proved much more adept at getting haircuts. Okay, I'm married. Last stages. Harlene and I have grown apart. She has become understandably impatient with my moods, my gloominess, my annoying personality. I am developing as a comic, and she is in the final year of college. Because of her, I have become familiar with some Kant, Kierkegaard, Schopenhauer, and Hegel. And while I can't really say I knew my ensoir from my poursoir, I was able to grasp that being with a small b in a bad marriage and being with a capital B in a bad marriage was not too dissimilar, no matter what Heidegger would say. By now, we were living right off Fifth Avenue in a brownstone 2.5-room apartment. It was relatively uneventful, except for one morning we woke up and a note was pushed under our door from the middle-aged lady who lived in the other apartment on our floor. It read, "I have gone out the window. Call the police." What was it about our neighbors and their compulsion to jump? Oh, and once I came home and found our apartment robbed. Some crook broke in, took nothing, but left us a portable TV set. I assume he stole it from another apartment, was in the midst of robbing us, panicked, and ran out, leaving it there. It was serendipitous, as we needed a second set. One night, we went out on a double date with another couple. The girl, as it turned out, was not happy in the relationship with the other guy, though I didn't guess it then. I was not thinking of other women, preoccupied as I was with becoming a comedian. I wrote routines, practiced, tried to quell my nerves, went to my psychoanalysis dutifully every day, hoping for that Perry Mason moment. Eureka! I remember now. I accidentally came upon my parents having sex, and the trauma that I've long repressed has caused my inordinate fear of being nailed shut in a cello case. The girl on the double date, good title for a thriller, lived near us. We were on 78th Street or 5th. She lived with her parents on 73rd and 5th. And there was nothing special about the evening, and I can't remember if the girl and the guy broke up or he moved out of town or what, but since she was a neighbor, my wife and I invited her over for dinner. She came. The three of us spent the evening talking, watching TV maybe. She was quite pretty and very charming, and I didn't realize how much she impressed me until I awoke in the middle of the night with a burning desire to marry her and live on the moon. She said she wanted to sing in clubs and was going to appear downtown for a few nights and invited us. I said we'd love to see her, but we were going to Washington, D.C. on a trip for a week. We wished her luck, and she left, though her smile remained like the Cheshire Cat's, and riddled with guilt, I quickly tried to put it under a sofa cushion. Soon after, Harlene and I went to Washington, a vacation that presumably would save our marriage. A week away from the tensions and familiar routines of Manhattan would reverse years of Hun-like aggression. So off we went by train to see the National Gallery, the Freya, the FBI building, the Mint, dine at Duke Ziebert's and the Occidental, and there in the nation's capital, among the unspeakable beauty of the cherry blossom trees, we fought. We argued, and the inspiring monuments to liberty and amazing veal francesa at Anna Maria's were not the magic bullets we'd hoped for. Home, hunched over my typewriter while my wife was at school, I took a break and called the girl on the double date to see how she had done in her cabaret debut. It was about 3 on an April afternoon. She was home and told me it seemed to go okay, and how was my trip? I babbled a bit about the Liberty Bell, forgetting it was in Philadelphia, and then with that sudden rush of impulsivity that Dostoevsky imputes to his gambler, I'm going to buy a jazz record. Feel like taking a walk? Sure, she said, and with that one word, my life made a seismic shift, though I didn't realize it. Moments later, I was in front of her building on Fifth Avenue, and the doorman, eyeing me like I was a spore culture, would not let me past him, but called up and said she would be right down. And there she was. She was 20 and startling in her impact as she bounced out of her building to greet this mere peasant deemed unfit to enter her lobby. She smiled and said hello, and as I stared at her smitten, I never dreamed that one day she would be my wife, and eventually she'd part, but remain friends for life. And now I'm 84, and she's 81, and if Chekhov were alive, he'd know what I'm groping for. She was Louise Lasser. The L's in her name were formed with the tongue, which was immediately sexual. The S's didn't hurt either. She had just dropped out in her final year from Brandeis. She was a blonde, beautiful creature, and while years of terrible illness and suffering have taken a great toll on her, you must believe me when I say she was a knockout. Okay, don't believe me. Hear these two testimonials. First, the milder one. I was in a cab with her, and when we came to our destination, she exited first, leaving me with the cabbie as I paid. "Who is that girl?" he said in astonishment. "She's amazing. So beautiful and so alive and charming." Okay, so that's one impartial voice, the voice of the common man. When she was going to Brandeis, the journalist Max Lerner and Jack Kennedy both hit on her. Not such common men. The second piece of evidence, her father took us to see Fiddler on the Roof, second or third row seats. We see the show, and I noticed among the pit musicians were a few I knew from the Tamament Orchestra. After the show was over, I walked a few feet to say hello. "Who is that girl you're with?" the drummer said to me. "Her name's Louise. She's my girlfriend." All the guys in the orchestra couldn't stop buzzing about her. We thought it was Brigitte Bardot. Okay, no one was as devastating as Bardot, but at 20, and with her ponytail, Louise somehow gave off a reminiscent vibe. She also resembled the very young, remarkably beautiful Mia Farrow, and would get sent newspaper photos of Mia with notes from friends and acquaintances saying, "I thought this was you." Many years later, I once showed a photo of young Louise to Mia's son Fletcher and asked him who it was. "It's a mom, isn't it?" he said. The long-winded point I'm making here is she was beautiful. But that was only one small part of her greatness. She was charming, smart as a whip, quick, very funny and witty. She was educated, raised in a Fifth Avenue duplex like the ones I'd seen on screen at the Midwood. She shopped with charge accounts at Tiffany's and Bergdorf's. Her father was a highly successful CPA whose red and blue tax book appeared in every bookstore in town. Her mother was an interior decorator. Her family took her to the best restaurants where all the maitre d's had known her since she was little. While I was growing up on linoleum eating Del Monte string beans out of a can, she was knocking off escargot on Fifth Avenue, where a livery doorman would get a cab for her so she could speed off to the theater and after to Giambelli's restaurant. She had a chesty voice, and carnal promise oozed out of every pore. She was also a little nuts, because God has a variety of dirty tricks up the heavenly sleeve of his white robe. But the bedlam was yet to come. Now it was April, and we walked through Central Park, then to the Jazz Record Center, a grubby walk-up shop that specialized in jazz records. One mounted a staircase that had a sign reading everything from bunk to monk, and entered a large room brimming over with jazz vinyl. As a kid, I could spend hours up there browsing, picking out a single record because one was as far as my nest egg stretched. The owner was an obese man named Joe, who sat somnambulistically as one rummaged through the bins and could barely mumble answers to my questions. I was reminded of an essay by one of those great essayists, Hazlitt or Lamb, bemoaning the fact that as a boy growing up with only a few cents, he spent so much time selecting a book to buy and how pleasurable it was. Now that he was older and could afford many books, the thrill was gone. But for me, there was a new thrill as I scanned the racks with Louise. I found the Johnny Dodds or George Lewis I wanted and bought her a Billie Holiday album, Lady Day. After all, she was a singer, and so she had to worship Billie Holiday, which of course she did. We strolled home, and when I came to her building, I thanked her for the walk and said I had some free afternoons if she'd like to spend some more time walking or seeing a movie. She said she had the following Tuesday free. We made a date to meet at the Fountain of the Plaza Hotel Tuesday at noon. Very Scott Fitzgerald. Who knew she would be Zelda? I walked home in a daze. Her head was swimming, too. I don't know why. I had nothing magical to offer. I think it was that I was good company, hip enough and amusing. I can't think of what else would have sent her into cloud nine. I was married, a runt, ill-clothed, a wannabe comic. Of course I could imagine she liked me. I only knew this person was the fulfillment of all my dreams and fantasies, and come Tuesday at noon, I could spend the whole afternoon with her till evening. I guess I was extra nice to my wife that night, although she was already bringing up the logistics of a looming split. Spellbound, I planned my afternoon with Louise, certain a call canceling was imminent. I trekked to the duplex and told my jokes. Jack Rollins and I ate, discussed comedy, but my mind was only half on my Max's special. Here was the plan, and see what you think of this. I wanted to have a fun, exciting afternoon with Louise. I didn't want to sit silently in a movie, the relationship not moving forward. What activity could I do with her where I could get a sense of how she felt with me, first off as a married guy, and second as a swain, a Lothario, a candidate for her heart. It was then I hit upon the perfect date, the racetrack. We could go out to Belmont. We could pick horses together, win some, lose some, laugh, commiserate. It was something different, most important, something active and alive. after, if all went well, maybe a quick dinner at the cave of Henri IV, a walk down candlelit French joint that reeked of romantic atmosphere, where I would order wine and strike brooding poses like Montgomery Clift. Cut to Tuesday morning. I rise, shave, shower, and dust my recluse's body with so much talcum powder I look like the wolf who tries to fool the seven little goats by coating himself with flour. I say goodbye to my wife, who will be gone at school all day. The fly in my sartorial ointment was my shoes. I had lousy shoes, and so I ducked into a shoe store en route to our rendezvous and bought a pair of handsome, if too small, shoes. Funny, they fit in the store. At noon, I sat on the lip of the fountain at the plaza, and moments later she appeared, looking smashing, with her beautiful long blonde hair, saucer eyes, chesty erotic voice, and me with my imbecilic smile. On the train to the track. Conversation seems to be going well. Then Belmont, placing bets, having laughs, handicapping by the names, losing mostly, but one win. Then on the train home, an icy depression sets in, and I start to sense things have not worked out. I'm so exhausted from being charming, it's like I ran the marathon. Now a waxing panic steals over me, and as the silences between comments grow longer, I am drowning in the conviction I've blown it. Flop sweat. My life is passing before my eyes like a movie, and I am being played by Franklin Pangborn. It's 6:30, and I suggest dinner, expecting to be dusted. Ink in the blow-off. But wait. What's this? She's up for it. Suddenly, we're over candlelight, and I'm ordering a bottle of Bordeaux. I know as much about wine as I know about horses or bipolar women. The trick is to position your eyes so it looks like you're checking the year on the menu, but really checking the prices. Stay with the most expensive you can afford. So we drink and chat, and after two glasses fuel my courage, I take her hand, and she's okay with it, and I can feel the ground beneath me shaking. There is some talk of my marital status, but I assure her quite truthfully that we married too young, and while my wife is lovely and brilliant, we both are on the verge of ending it. I leave out the part that Harleen is a nice, normal young woman, perfectly capable of having a fine and healthy marriage, but not with an immature, maladjusted wreck like me. I get the check. We rise, and in the shadows of the cave, I kiss her. She meets me halfway, and I'm standing there, my lips suctioned to hers, thinking, I am now kissing Louise. You wanted to know what it would feel like, says the little man who lives in my head and hates me. Well, this is it. Now it's 10 minutes later, and she is pulling cash from her bag. I'm tapped out between slow horses, new shoes, and a bottle of Gruau La Rose. She is plunking it down in the palm of a carriage driver's hand. It is the first of three payments she shells out for as we do Central Park, over and over, kissing relentlessly in the privacy of the buggy. When I get home, my eyes are rolled heavenward like the praying saints on the walls of the Vatican. Why is your tongue so black? Asked my wife. Must be something I ate, I flute back in a guilty falsetto. Some berries. You hate fruit, the ball and chain says. I gave them a try, I say, my nose growing with every word I speak. I want to talk to you. I want to discuss how we do it if we broke up, she announces. I am ready for this dismantling, having fortuitously stumbled upon the neurotic's philosopher's stone, the overlapping relationship. And so we did break up, and Louise and I began a love affair, and I remember exactly where we were when I first realized what love was and what it felt like, and finally I got what they mean, the poets, the lyricists. We'd been dating for a few weeks. I had moved out and taken a very romantic apartment with a fireplace in the bathroom. Not that I ever used it. I used the bathroom, not the fireplace. but we used the fireplace in the living room and spent all our waking and sleeping moments together. And one afternoon, we were at the Museum of Modern Art having coffee in their restaurant, and for whatever reason, I was looking at Louise and felt, oh my God, I love this woman. I never felt like this about anyone before. Now I see what you're talking about. And somewhere in heaven, that same character that toyed sadistically with Job had come across my picture in the files and was rubbing his hands together with anticipatory glee.
Concluding with a biblical reference. How about that? Shout out to Job. Context of white supremacy. Alki Beach, again, lamest beach in Seattle. Very pretty day, though. Excellent to be at the beach, even Lane Beach. That is our first audio segment. Woody Allen's Apropos of Nothing. I said I had computer problems and had to compensate, so I did have a slight rewind there for the folks listening live. We'll edit that for the archive. But other than that, got through, even through tough circumstances. I'm just pointing this out before I give out the number. We are still pretty early in the book, but this is our third installment, and we have yet to get details on exactly how did Sun Yi come into the picture. Just for scale of the books, quite a ways before we get to the end, but still no information on all of these adopted non-white children. Number to dial is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. The number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks can definitely let us know, what do you make of him indicting this teacher as racist? Remember, this book was published last year. So even though he's talking about things that happened decades ago, like a half century ago, this was published last year. So, yeah, we'll just keep that in mind. But what do folks make of this indictment, racist teacher and all that? I'll go back and get the passage later. But anywho, the email untiljustice@gmail.com. Get to some of the emails. Let's see. One of our investors wrote in. Number one, the German to English translation of Alan's original last name, Konigsberg, I think that's it. Konigsberg, is Mountain King. I would be surprised if he did not know the English translation. I suspect changing Mountain King to Woody, phallus reference, would have provided a fascinating analysis for Dr. Welsing. I concur. Number two, I thought the discussion by Alan about his early career as a writer on TV shows and movies is important. Writers on these shows wield tremendous power if they are white. And all the folks he's named are white, I think. Words are important. Heard that a few times. Reportedly, as of 2017, less than 5% of writers on U.S. TV shows and movies are black. Not surprised at all. Probably at the time Alan was writing this, it was probably zero. Even so-called black shows. I think we got one of them right here. Some of the folks right that he was writing about, his homies, are famous for writing for black shows. All that stuff. The Jeffersons and all that. White writers. Nothing new. Continuing. If not the majority or all being white, black actors have a long history of conflicts with writers on TV shows regarding their portrayal. John Amos on Good Times, right in the era we're talking about, and T.C. Carson on Living Single. Now, that's like light years ahead from where we are. But yeah, that 90s, right in the middle of where we were with Tupac and all that. Much obliged, one of our investors. Again, the email untiljustice@gmail.com. Nab some of our other emails. We'll double check, see if there are folks who dialed in *61 if you have commentary to share on the first portion of the reading. Again, what do we make of this racist teacher memory? I mean, he's lived 80 years on the planet, so he's got lots of stories to tell and more to come. We haven't even got halfway through the book yet. What to make of this racist teacher memory that he shares with us? Let's see. We'll hit the switchboard, see if folks have thoughts on the first portion of the reading. Folks look like they're spectating a little bit for the first portion. I will share a few notes and then keep an eye on the switchboard, see if folks have thoughts. Oh, there, I guess they were. Needed a little bit more time. 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you have thoughts. Let's see. Mo in Dallas, have you with us? Look for other hands as I see them.
Greetings, Gus. Thank you. I'm actually traveling to a place where I can speak freely. If you can give me a minute and a half.
I think we can spare, 90 seconds? Maybe even 100. Let's see. We'll check for other folks. I'll share what I said, a few of my notes, and then we'll get Mo and see if there are any other folks who have thoughts as well. Incidentally, I will say this is definitely not threatening like my top 10 favorite books all time. It is no Medical Apartheid. It is no Invisible Man, but wow. And we haven't even gotten to the whole reason why we're reading this, which was he speaks so cavalierly about his raping children. What can I say? Sun Yi. We haven't even got to that. Like, that's why we're reading it. However, I have been very interested. Let's see. Let's just get to the notes. But I've been very interested in what we've read thus far. And especially, I would just say the names that he's mentioning, these white writers' words are important. Man, I bet if you looked like at their catalog, the projects that they were involved in, I suspect for lots of folks, it would be like, oh, wow, I had no idea that, you know, such and such was involved with this and that and all the rest of it. Let's see. Notes that I started taking this week. So talking about his first wife, Harleen, he says, yes, I loved Harleen, but I had no idea what love meant, what to expect, what not to expect, what was required. So how do you know that you loved her if you were so confused about what this concept means? I think that's why many of us have said, hey, words are important. That's one right there. Like, what are you even talking about? Like, slow down. Stop. Because, I mean, hey, there are supposed to be exactly what he said. There are supposed to be expectations, requirements. What does that even mean since I'm saying it? Absolutely. All that is very important. Next, he says, talking about Harleen, who he loved, I was so glad when she was gone because there was not a single thing we could agree on, not a single compromise either of us was capable of making, and we battled like hitmen in a castleman war. I know I messed that pronunciation up, but whatever. You got the gist of the metaphor. I mean, I thought you loved this person. Compromise is a part of love. Not, it's going to be my way every time, every day, and, you know, no give and take. Nah. Give no quarter. Nah. I thought you loved me. Nah. And really? And even when he gets into like the descriptions of, you know, saying that he was moody and nasty to her parents, like, what is the appeal of this guy exactly? Why would you even want to kick it and be around him even as a friend? He goes into more detail about what a great guy he is. He says, at 3 a.m., I rise with unbearable queasiness. We call an emergency service, which sends one of those anonymous freelance doctors on duty all night. A stranger comes. He injects me. The nausea abates. I sleep. This routine happens often. It was not until I entered psychoanalysis, and this is over years. Like, can you imagine this? This goes on. This is a regular occurrence, nightly or several times a week or whatever it is, where you have to deal with all this. Like, are you serious? Are you serious? And then we come back. He says about him supposedly going to the draft. I thought I had a whole lot of thoughts just on that alone. Like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I have sat here and heard all this. My former president sat there and said that no count Colin Kaepernick should be fired, you know, kick his behind out of the country and everything, disparaging our troops and men and women who have gone and fought and served and died for this country. And old Woody Allen, no count coward, looking to make up any reason and then to give this long, unnecessary sarcasm about, oh, no, it's no way I want to do all this and be in a barracks with all these guys and blah, 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 and go eat bad food. We got it. You don't want to. You're a coward. You don't want to serve. You're not a patriot. We got it. Got it. Got it. Got it. Didn't expect anything else. And he says that so he gets kicked out. They say he's biting his nails. So, OK, for a 4F status. Matter of fact, this is at least the second person that we've read in our book club who got rejected from the military. Minister Malcolm X got the same, I think, 4F status when we read his autobiography and saying, you're crazy, get out of here, because he'd get the gun and go shoot white people. Anywho, he says, now they wouldn't have to bunk next to a guy who sobs himself to sleep clutching a small cloth bear. I have since, at my wife's insistence, given up nail biting, replacing that disgusting habit with a more socially acceptable coprolalia. I had to stop and look that one up. I looked it up, and that word means the involuntary and repetitive use of obscene language as a symptom of mental illness or organic brain disease. I mean, what to say about this Woody Allen guy? Like, this sort of behavior where you're constantly referencing kind of hedonistic things and debauchery and even self-referencing how you're just an obscene louse, that just further for me makes me think, yeah, this is someone that I could think of as raping children. Like, you're an obscene louse. That's the sort of behavior that I would expect. And you self-identify in that way so frequently, and it's got some sort of sexual connotation to it. Like, yeah, that's why we're reading this book. What does it mean to be white? Why are we reading this book? Or at least what caught Gus's attention. Now, I said with those names, now I don't know all these folks that he's name dropping. Doc Simon and Sid Caesar and Mel Brooks. Now, some of these names are more familiar than others. Danny Kaye, Joe Layton. But I mean, wow, some of these folks are like titans in terms of white supremacy entertainment. Mel Brooks, Blazing Saddles. I think we heard Neely Fuller Jr. in the audio that played before we went live. He mentioned Richard Pryor. Mel Brooks, one of the first movies that you will see on Internet Movie Database for Mel Brooks is Blazing Saddles. Richard Pryor. That's what I mean about all in white supremacy entertainment. Exactly what I said. Now, if you go and look at these folks' film library, some of the folks that he mentioned last week did projects with Shirley Temple. I don't know if people are familiar with her, a little white girl with the blonde curls, and she would do like minstrel dances with black actors at that time, that sort of thing. Normally they were servants bringing her some dessert or whatever to satisfy her white needs. But this is the type of content that these folks produced. And I would submit, even if you haven't seen Blazing Saddles or Shirley Temple or some of the other projects that they were involved in, Danny Kaye apparently was in one of the first episodes of The Cosby Show. Regardless of whether you've seen their work or not, I suspect that you have been influenced by it because, as I said, these folks are like titans in white supremacy entertainment. Next. Oh, here we go. Here we go. Okay. So he says, wrote sketches. Okay. The other sketch writer was David Panich, an odd and brilliant character whom I owe much to. He was 10 years older than me, dazzlingly brilliant, immense erudition, could draw with the precision of Durer or Dali. He wrote poetry, he read everything, and he played boogie woogie on the piano. He hated modern jazz, but he had lived among all the great modern jazz giants, Monk, Miles, and had a romance with Charlie Parker's wife. He was a gifted sculptor who carved the famous carving on Charlie Mingus's base. His apartment on Roosevelt Island was like entering a spaceship, ultra modern. His own paintings on the walls, always morbid subject matter like his poetry. He earned money as a school teacher in Harlem and was quite racist about blacks, and yet all his students loved him, and he took them to museums and restaurants. Now, when he says all his students loved him, I got the impression that his students were black, especially saying that he was teaching in Harlem at that time. This is before gentrification, presumably. So that's the way I took it. Maybe I'm wrong. It continues. All his students loved him, and he took them to museums and restaurants, always on his own dime, and to his house. He imitated them offensively. He had been in mental institutions, and I'm going to stop right there. Now, wait a minute. This guy is teaching black students, taking them to his house, imitating them, and he's got some sort of mental problems enough to where he's been institutionalized. Like, oh, I don't even know where to begin. Like, Jesus Lord, like, woo. If there is a reason, a motivation to replace white supremacy with justice, Woody Allen gave it to you in about one paragraph. Jesus Christ, like, before you get to the bedroom, like, what is our academic plan for the first 10, 15 years of our child's life? Do we want our child to be taught by someone who was a racist? This is a white person saying this guy is racist about blacks, and yet all his students love them, imitates them offensively. And it does. I mean, Woody Allen is paying compliments to this guy, so it's not like his racism was enough for you to be like, hey, man, Dave, I'm not kicking it with you anymore, man. You're racist, and I'm not sitting around here for you making racist jokes about black people, and you teach these students. You can come around and be a racist. Psh, get out of here, man. I don't want to kick it with you. I don't want to learn anything from you. Learn how to be a little racist, white supremacist, and go. That's not what Woody Allen says. Just, man, this guy's racist. And generally, if a white person says that you're a racist, I generally take that to be like, wow, you have got to be like way past like Klan member. Like, it's got to be like way like extreme as can be for a white person to say, oh yeah, this guy is a racist. Because you didn't even have too many white people saying that my man with the clip, Donald Sterling, you didn't even have too many white people saying that Donald Sterling was racist. Donald Trump, that's about it. Let's see, next. Oh, and he comes double down. So he comes back and he says, in an era before marijuana became a middle class cliche, he was high a lot. This is the same racist Dave Panish. His connection was a black woman named Hazel in Harlem. She doesn't have a last name. That's why I said it's got to be black students that he's teaching. He risked much in those days, jail and his teacher's license. He was a user, not a dealer, but being high made him laugh easily, and he was a great audience for me. Now, again, they push the vice to the niggers, the pornography, the narcotics. Yes, we'll let the niggers do that. And then when we say that, oh, wait a minute, cannabis is medicinal. Now, Hazel, get out of here, Hazel. We don't need you anymore. Now, we will take over and make billions of dollars, and Hazel probably has a criminal record and is institutionalized herself, and we'll get no money from all of this. Probably been gentrified right on out of Harlem. Unless I've been misinformed. Let's see. Malcolm X talked about this too. Supplying the white people. He talked about this exactly. Like, man, yes, white people like Woody Allen and his folks coming down for jazz or black sex or drugs or all of the above, and I'll hook you, I'll be a courier for you. We read all this, right, Minister Malcolm, right? I guess I could pause. It's been 2 minutes. Oh, wait a minute. Let me get one more. So we got all the, wait a minute, let me get two more. So I mentioned this about all these folks with television, right? Jackie Gleason. Going to get a double down on Richard Pryor again, because we talked about this. Jackie Gleason with a toy where Richard Pryor can't get a job in Louisiana. He tries to go and get a job. They won't hire him. He gets hired to wear a dress and serve fried chicken to white men and white women. He gets fired. He's cleaning. And then his white child, Shirley Temple, man, Shirley Temple, like firing it. It's right. Shirley Temple, his white child, who's about 8 years old, right at Shirley Temple's age. His white son says, oh, I wanted to be my toy, my friend. That's what the movie's called, The Toy. I wanted to hire him, come be my toy. He could play with me. And so I can throw food on him and take embarrass him in front of other people in public and all the rest of it. Like, that's Jackie Gleason. Now, he did The Honeymooners, too. I think that'd probably be the first thing that popped up for Jackie Gleason. But, I mean, the racist. Oh, man, Mr. Fuller, can we get one? The Hustler, that's Jackie Gleason, too. That's racism, white supremacy. That's why I said, if you knew these people's names and their bodies of work, Mel Brooks and Larry Gelbart, Mel Tolkien, all of these white people. Wow. Neil Simon. This is the history of racism, white supremacy, entertainment. The addiction that everybody has right now and Netflix and all of that. These white people set the foundation for all of that. Go look on Internet Movie Database at some of these folks' body of work. Mike Stewart, Shelley Keller, Neil Simon. I bet even if you're not big fans of all this, it'll be like, oh, yeah, I know what that is. Oh, yeah, I got it. Okay. Last one, and then we'll see folks on the phone. Let's see. I'm just trying to check Neil Simon to see if anything jumps out at me right here. Let's see. Neil Simon. The Sunshine Boys. The Odd Couple. Okay, so I haven't seen many of these films or any of these films, but these names strike me as being familiar. These are films that, legendary films that they talk about all the time. And this guy, Neil Simon, he has 100 credits as a writer for different things that he's written over the years. That's why I said, oh, yeah, like this is the foundation for white supremacy, racism. I'm sure Mr. Fuller, if you mentioned some of these folks' names to Mr. Fuller, he'd probably know some of their films and such. Anyway, last one I'll get in. He mentioned going to the White House to see President Johnson right after Malcolm X's assassination, right after Kennedy's assassination. How in the world does a louse like Woody Allen get invited to the White House to see President Johnson? Now, this is young in his life. This is before he's made all these films and won an Academy Award and all this. How was he invited to the White? Like, what has he done at this point in his life that, oh, yeah, I'm worthy of being invited to the White House? I bet failed marriages and what? Tell me something. What does it mean to be white? Now, I pause there. Let's see. Mo in Dallas, if you're free, line should be open, or did you need more time?
Can I be heard?
Crystal, sir.
Thank you. Greetings, Gus. Greetings, listeners and callers. Again, thank you for the program, and thank you for my additional time. My notes will be short. The first thing I wrote down when listening to the first audio segment, Ms. Reading, was confusing. The way that he structures his piece of literature is very unorganized, and it led me to believe it is intently unorganized and jumbled, if you will. He weaves in and out of stories and scenarios a lot of times, deterring from major points and confusing you. Like during the reading, I was confused if he was implying that his psychoanalysis worked or helped or didn't help. I've made the conclusion that it didn't help because he again spoke disparaging about it, but it's still a very conflicting structure in his literature. He did admit to draft dodging. I wrote the question, did he admit to draft dodging? Because it sounded like that's what he was doing. It was a very tacky way to admit to draft dodging, in my opinion, minimize and sort of, you know, poke fun at, men who are qualified to join any armed forces is just offensive. And, I believe, if he was a black person, this book wouldn't have been released, speaking so ill the armed services and serving his great nation. Colin Kaepernick. I do appreciate Gus's initiative with looking up the word that he used when for curtailing his nail biting habit. He spoke so quickly. I thought he said capoeira, which is a West African fighting style. I thought that's what he was claiming to pick up, as opposed to nail biting, which was confusing to me in itself. He didn't, but that still stuck out because he speaks so much, and it's just a lot. I feel he chose to narrate his book purposely so that he could sort of lead the whoever is experiencing this literature in this audio form to a certain type of mindset. It's not working for me personally, but I can see how the way he mashes so much information together, I can see how you can miss or he could gloss over a major key point and you not catch it, or a reader or listener not catch it, simply because he is rambling, and a lot of the time your attention is, even though you're paying attention, you're kind of not. I also noted the racist teacher. He was quite racist about blacks, but his black students loved him, and he imitated them offensively. I wrote down racist jokes just because that's what I understood that he was implying, and he seemed to accept it. Like, this is condonable, acceptable behavior. Like, oh yeah, my friends are racist, you know? And I believe that teacher was surrounding himself with black people as a form of consumption. Black elite jazz musicians, but he hated jazz, but he can play boogie woogie on the piano. Being alone with the black children in his home, yet he dislikes them, but he likes to feed them. It put me in the mind of Delectable Negro, the Delectable Negro in my mind. Thank you, my.
I guess before you mute Mo and Dallas, with the teacher component, David Panic, and this guy has an Internet Movie Database page as well. So his teaching the Negros in Harlem was his moonlighting. This guy, David Panic, he wrote for Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, which is like a legendary television program. He wrote for The Dean Martin Show, legendary television program. He wrote for The Monkees, they had a TV program, legendary as well. Like, this is not some... he has an Internet Movie Database page, one, and then two, it's pretty full. He's got 16 writing credits, and it's like 16 writing credits, but he wrote for, like I said, some of these are television programs, so he was on them for a whole season. So it's not like he just wrote 16 things. Like, this is a long list of white people who've had a lot of influence in practicing racism, white supremacy, entertainment. But my question really quick was going to be, did that remind, or if people remember, so you specifically, Mo and Dallas and anybody else, the teacher, did that remind you? Remember when we read the biography on Albert Einstein, Frederick Jerome, their work, and he was talking about the same thing. Albert Einstein would leave Princeton and he would go play with the young black children and have them come hang out in the house. And some of us were kind of like, if you all remember, I know it's been a minute, but anybody, Mo and Dallas, did you remember, did it give you the kind of, something creepy. This could be Woody Allen too, like something creepy could be going on, or is that just me? When I say creepy, I mean sexual.
Oh, definitely.
Okay. Okay.
Yes, definitely. There's a lot of Einsteinisms in this reading, and not just with that teacher, with Allen himself, with his own consumption of just how he chooses to engage with non-white people. It's always an uncomfortable or an awkward. It's a funeral. He's trying to get them to teach him something. It's always a take. And yes, I definitely see that. I thought about how he could meet the president. And like you were just saying, he was associated and connected to so many powerful people. I'm thinking maybe someone he knew allowed him to know the president. Like, it's very possible. I see, 6 degrees of separation. This guy knew a guy, the Phil and the other Phil. But with that being said, I think before he, and I don't think he was poor. But I think before he had a lot of money, he was financially stable. And I think he's exaggerating his impoverished status. And I think he has also been maybe in his formative years, way younger than he'd like to admit, he was always well connected. And he downplays it because it's not a big deal for him. And I take that point because he's downplayed a lot of things so far that that are huge deals to me personally. I mute my line.
Where do you place the emphasis? And incidentally, you were saying this book is difficult to follow because it seems like he's rambling and kind of talking about nonsense. At least the version that I have, maybe these are chapters because there are breaks on certain pages. So maybe they're chapters, but they're not titled. They're not numbered. I'm guessing maybe these are chapters as opposed to just breaks in the text for a moment. But the title of this book is Apropos of Nothing, which basically is about nothing. So that may be a major clue or signal to the reader that, hey, if you're thinking this is going to be some organized, coherent, tightly bound together project, that's not what this is. This is kind of my ramblings, and it doesn't even have chapters, is what I'm saying, in the way that it's put together, and for whatever purpose that serves, for me to be able to as you were saying, kind of, I can manipulate readers in a certain way if I can tell my story in this manner. I don't know, maybe there's an audience that appreciates a narrative being told like this. I have totally ulterior motives for why I'm reading the text, so, even have to go back to that text for a minute, because I mean, woo. And he even linked it to Thelonious Monk, who is mentioned in this text. He said that Woody Allen said the first dead body he saw, Thelonious Monk, necrophilia. And then you got all this consumption of black jazz artists and everything all throughout the text from so many different white people. And this is happening in the middle of the civil rights movement there in New York. Minister Malcolm X is alive and talking and all that. There's no mention of, hey, civil rights movement is happening. Negroes, but you've got this racist teacher, and it's no mention of, oh, yeah, Dr. King, March on Washington, blah, blah, blah. All of that stuff is happening in the midst of this, and that's not included at all. He's just talking about TV shows and all the rest of it. He could even get in Bill Cosby. Real talk, like, I Spy came at this time. I think that was mentioned last week. Like, hey, Bill flipping Cosby, Sidney flipping Poitier, all of that is right now. He mentioned Harry Belafonte. Like, it could be so much more in terms of what gets it. Mo in Dallas just mentioned, where is our emphasis? What do we focus on? Where do we place significance? But I got to go back to this passage with the teacher, David Panic, again, who wrote for Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, wrote for the Dean Martin Show, the Monkees television show, that was this week, like enormous film credits and hugely popular programs throughout the 60s and into the 70s. David Panic hated modern jazz, but had lived among all the great modern jazz giants, Monk, Miles, and had a romance with Charlie Parker's wife. Now, you can even pause right there, like, really? I don't know who Charlie Parker's wife is, but is this some white guy who's going and sleeping with a black person's wife? And all of that sexual deviance, Malcolm X talked about that, to come hang out with black people, said that they paid him. That was his job. Come get somebody like a David Panic. Yeah, you want some black sex? I got you. I got you. Male, female, whatever you need, I got you. Drugs? Go back and reread Minister Malcolm X's autobiography if you forgot. He says he was a gifted sculptor, David Panic, who carved the famous carving on Charlie Mingus's base. The apartment on Roosevelt Island was like entering a spaceship. What a metaphor. Ultra modern, his own paintings on the wall, always morbid subject matter, necrophilia, like his poetry. He earned his money as a school teacher in Harlem, and was quite racist about blacks, and yet all his students loved him. It's got to be, yeah, black students. Got it. Now that, again, now these are children, but I mean, you have a flagrantly racist teacher who imitates black people in a derisive way, but his students love him. And they'll say, we're experts about racism. Now, again, I don't expect, he didn't say what age, I don't expect these students to be, you know, scholars and counter racism by any stretch, but I mean, and this is in the middle of the civil rights movement. Their parents didn't come and see this guy. You're like, man, I don't know, something odd about this guy. I'm out of here. It continues, he was racist about blacks, and yet all the students loved him. And he took them to the museums and restaurants, always on his own dime, and to his house. Ooh, that's right out of Albert Einstein. We read that, Albert Einstein on race and racism. Took him to his own house. He imitated them offensively. He had been in a mental institution. Again, I just stopped right there. Like, what? How do you get hired to teach? Oh, the niggers, doesn't matter. You can go be a convict. You going to teach at the nigger school? No problem. let me get you a tie instead of that orange jumpsuit. No problem. Make sure you take your shackles off before you go to teach them. Standards for the Negro children. Let's see. All right, so I didn't finish my notes. The rest of what I highlighted for this portion. He talks about being at this social setting. And he wanted to leave, but he's so neurotic. You know, they're going to check me out. They're going to see me. All of that, I just tie back to white genetic annihilation. All of this fear about all these unnatural and unwarranted things. They're going to see me. Oh, what are they going to see me? They're going to see me if I'm trying to escape out the window. Oh, they'll see me if I leave early. Ooh. And it strikes me as someone who I'm doing incorrect things regularly. I might get caught. He says, he loves Sid Caesar. He regaled me with his romantic adventures, and I marveled at how a small Jew, whatever that means, could mesmerize one magnificent woman after another. Lots of sexual exploits here. Just that alone. I mean, I guess that's something that is praised in white culture, the sexual conquest, especially for white men and white women. But something about this in this context, for me, it's just further driving the point. There is so much sexual deviance underpinning all of the works. Everything Woody Allen touches, Woody. Even his flipping name, Moset Woody. It's so much sexual deviance. I mean, it is an obsession. It's everywhere. You can't even talk about anything without something sex and some kind of sexual deviance popping up within the conversation. Let's see. Then we come right back, very next page. So they're going to go to the hot tub. Now, pause. This fella just told us, hey, I was an athlete. I was a ball player. Baseball was my thing, man. I get out there with that mitt and do it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, if you did all that, you've been in the locker room with guys, right? That's a part of sports, being in the locker room. You got to change clothes. Take your jersey off, put your regular clothes back on. Maybe even take a shower, right? If that's the case, why would it be such a big deal to go sit in the steam room with your friend? These are not strangers that you've never met before. These are your homies. Go sit in the steam room for 30 minutes. No. They might see me. That, again, that all that neurosis, white genetic annihilation. Rife throughout white culture, even. Because he says, even though I was new on the job and loved them both, I wouldn't get naked and sit in a steam room with two guys. Okay, I'm sure you would do it if it was Jerry Sandusky. Remember him? I'm sure he would have done it if it had been a room full of young girls. 12, 11. Oh, yeah, I'm right there. Let's see. And girls keep saying, I pointed that out before. I'm so glad I said that. When he did that interview with Dick Cavett in 1971, a little bit ahead of where we are chronologically, he kept saying, girls, I like a girl. I like a girl. I like a girl. He was in his 30s then, mid-30s. He was closer to 40 than he was 25, even 30, I think, at that point. I'd have to go back and double check. But, I mean, he was not a spring chicken, as I said. To have someone who's 35, pushing 40, talking about, oh, I like a girl. I like a girl. I like girls. I like girls. Not women. Not even ladies. And he's been married at this point. You're talking about how much you like girls. And then in the text, it just continues. Then there was Larry Matthews' beauty salon where the guys would go see guys. He didn't say boys. He said guys would go also to pick up girls. And what girls? All the beautiful showgirls and chorus girls. And went there with the nightclubs closed to be made even more beautiful. I never was good at picking up chorus girls and proved much more adept at getting haircuts. Girls, girls, girls. Do you even try to pick up women? Are you even interested in women? Let's see. He continues. So he says, So he comes in. His apartment has been robbed. He says, some crook broke in, took nothing, but left us a portable TV set. I assume he stole it from another apartment, was in the midst of robbing us, panicked, and ran out, leaving it there. It was serendipitous as we needed a second set. Now, I paused there because I said, hey, what did they call this? Hot merchandise? Something that has been stolen? That's his conclusion. Somebody broke in. They were going to rob us. They left it here. This was stolen from someone else. Upstanding citizen, police, I'd like to report a break-in from my residence, and then I think there might be stolen property here. Might be one of the neighbors. He could have broken into one, someone who lives on your floor, your hallway. Nope. Mine now. We needed a new TV. What did it say? The fruit doesn't fall far from the tree, because he spent the whole first portion of the book talking about how his dad was a gangster and a thug and a criminal and trafficked in stolen merchandise. Remember that? Got his mom a fur coat. Let's see. Then he wakes up. He wants to cheat on his wife. Got all that more sexual deviance. Why not just break up with her? You could do that. You're making money. You're writing. You can take care of yourself. Get a divorce. Do things properly. Nah. I don't want to do that. Let's see. Like I said, the sexual inappropriateness, it's on every page. It's literally every paragraph. That's what's holding my attention through all of this. Why, like, what in the world, Gus? We read O.J. Simpson at the beginning of the year. Like, why this? We were supposed to be reading Shaft. Like, yeah, I would have loved to read. We will get to Shaft. It'll sound great now once we get to read these two together because they are so similar. The book. Well, really both. Wait till we get to Shaft. Anywho, the sexual inappropriateness is, it's every paragraph if you're just paying attention to what's here. And probably the more you know about these white people that he's talking about, you probably catch even more of it, knowing about their behaviors. But he writes, he says, she had a chesty voice. This is talking about Louise's second wife. She had a chesty voice and carnal promise oozed out of every pore. Now, I've highlighted his use of the word ooze in this text. He was talking about a black musician and saying that talent oozed out of them. And I said, that's kind of an odd. If this is supposed to be a compliment, you generally don't say that someone is oozing something constructive. You generally think of ooze, ew, yuck, gross, which is the way that he uses it the second time in the text, where he said he was oozing an unfounded confidence. And I said, bing, that fits, that works, no problem, because this is not really a compliment. Third time we see it, he says she had a chesty voice and carnal promise oozed out of every pore. Now, I mean, that is not a compliment. You normally would say, oh, wow, this is a lovely young lady. Great figure. That would be a classy way. No. Carnal delight oozed, or carnal promise oozed out of every pore. Now, I mean, really. I guess for carnal, make sure we look that one up as well. Relating to physical, especially sexual needs and activities. Sexual obsession, Woody, and since this is cheating on his wife with all this carnal oozing, it's sexual deviance every time. Sex with your mom, cheating on your wife, sex with a black person, all of the above. It's just all over. Sex with children, getting to that later. Thought this was important. Biblical metaphors, I keep saying that. So, and that's right after. So sex, carnal delight, carnal hope oozing out of every pore. She was also a little nuts because God has a variety of dirty tricks up the heavenly sleeve of his white robe. Now, that's so much. The biblical metaphors that I talked about, white association with God, of course. Dirty tricks generally associated with black. And this is right next to the sexual oozing and carnal delights. Last one again. He mentioned them walking through Central Park. Just reminded me of the Central Park Five, raping black males, of course. Carnal delights, they say. And then he's lying to his wife. He refers to her as a ball and chain. This is a woman he said he loved, right? Now she's a ball and chain. And it's not like she's messing up his life. He just lies and goes out and does whatever he wants to anyway. So it's not like if we're saying ball and chain metaphor, this person is restricting or prohibiting my movement, my freedom to do what I want and actualize and live my best life. That's not true at all. Lion Woody Allen. Any other folks' comments they want to make sure they get in before we get to audio segment number two? What does it mean to be white? Mo in Dallas, yes, sir.
Good. Yeah. Can I ask you a question? Do you think, now this is about the steam room, do you think he would have went in that room if the two gentlemen in the room were non-white black males? Insert musician or actor if you want. But do you think he would have went in?
Absolutely. The way that they have... and I'm saying they here, even though you asked me about Woody Allen, because he's talked about so many other white people in this book who have also fetishized black male entertainers specifically, black male musicians specifically. So absolutely, if it had been Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk, his name will come to me in a second. But if it had been any of these black musicians at the time, or probably wouldn't even have to be a musician, even Sidney Poitier, absolutely. He would have been front and center. It wouldn't have been, front and center. I'm right there. Oh, Charlie Parker. Oh, absolutely.
I came to the same conclusion. I figured he would have used, In my mind, and I may be a bit of a cynic in some areas, or I just expect people to do what their history has proven. But I think he would have used that experience to as a writing material, in some sense. I think he would have wanted to do it for the experience, in my opinion. But I mute my line.
I agree completely. I think this, so like I said, the fetishizing of black people in particular, and even the teacher, he's bringing them to the house and feeding, these are children. So yeah, if it had been some black musicians that they liked and all the rest of it, absolutely. Good point. Necrophilia, it has a sexual component to it as well. I think that's strong. And then homoeroticism, but I would say homoeroticism that is specific to black males seems so prominent in all of this, everything that we've read. And I suspect that's just going to continue as we continue with the text and everything. But any other comments? Folks want to make sure they get in. Let's see. Check here. anything else? We'll certainly have time once the second audio segment concludes. But if folks are all set, we will go ahead and get started. I was so upset. I wanted to get the fella's name because we right there and we just read it. And I can't believe it's taking me so long to get it. I guess I'll say it on the other side. Anywho, we will continue with Woody Allen's Apropos of Nothing. Audio segment number 2 on the context of white supremacy. If we missed your commentary, you know you have something, just write it down and we will have ample time once we get done. Context of white supremacy, audio segment number 2.
It turned out Louise's mother had some serious mental problems. And when I say serious, I mean she was in and out of institutions and needed shock treatment for bouts of at least depression. This in and out had wreaked havoc on Louise, an only child, as it would have on anyone. I chose to overlook certain red flags from the start because I really wanted this to turn out right. For one thing, when I asked Louise why she had dropped out of Brandeis in her final year, it turned out upon persistent questioning to have been some psychological problems, not just to pursue acting and singing, as she had said. Then there was the manic energy, which was so invigorating, especially coming from a bright, funny sex dream. It seemed a shame, too manic, too frantic, but what the hell did I know about manic behavior? In my family, there would have been no suspicion of mental problems, as nothing short of running naked down the street brandishing a meat cleaver was recognized as odd behavior. Probably the most obvious sign something was amiss was her room. Picture a beautifully decorated Fifth Avenue duplex apartment housing father, mother, daughter. The furniture, some of which was designed by the mother, is sleek, with every lamp, ashtray, chair, and table understated and tasteful, arranged with a gentle simplicity. The colors are muted pastels, soft blues and grays. There is much cherry wood. Everything is in place and looks perfect to the eye. One gets the impression the objects have a number on them that corresponds with their number on the table. The effect is meticulous and lovely. One ascends the staircase and comes to Louise's room. One opens the door to it and sees Hiroshima, the bed unmade, drawers wide open, clothes strewn about, creams, lotions everywhere, jars and squeezed tubes uncapped, the tops God knows where, the bathroom cabinets are wide open, and many items normally used and put back after are on the sink, on the edge of the tub. There is a box on the night table with a half-eaten slice of cold pizza from what day one can't estimate, along with a wax half cup of coffee with a drowned butt in it. Open books and lots of sheet music lie scattered about on top and under laundry. The room is the dramatic opposite of the meticulously calculated beauty of the rest of the apartment. A statement. But saying what? Inside, I am out of control? Or, this is how my mind is furnished? Or, Mom, this is how I react to your compulsive neatness, to your scrupulously arranged interior decorating? To any simpleton, that room would have told the whole story, foretold the whole future. But I wasn't any simpleton. I was a simpleton extraordinaire, in love with the apotheosis of my dreams, and wading through the debris, I chose to rationalize it. I guess the maid's been sick, I piped. She was here yesterday, was the answer. And then I was making love to a goddess. And if fastidiousness was not her thing, I'll accept the trade. Louise and I would go together for 8 years before we married. During that time, we lived together on and off, mostly on. In that 8-year ride on the wild mouse, she would be unfaithful, on diets, in and out of hospitals, on grass, on drugs, recreational and medicinal, manic, very self-deprecating, see After the Fall by Arthur Miller, followed abruptly by a Category 5 hurricane of euphoria, trying to act, trying to sing, trying to stay alive, trying to be my girlfriend, incredibly exciting to be with on the good days, which got fewer and fewer, deceitful, charming, helpful and encouraging to my career, maddening, adorable, sad, full of sharp insights, always funny. In all my future writing over the years, she remained my blonde lady of the sonnets. When I did a scene acting with Angelica Houston and duplicated Louise's bedroom, that terrific actress looked at me incredulously and said, "Who did you ever know who had a room like this?" And I'm thinking, "Oh, just some girl I married." So now I'm playing the duplex. And in addition to Jack Rollins and Charlie, Louise is there coaching me, criticizing me, helping me, throwing her insights in with Jack's. They hit it off, and he tried managing her abortive singing career, but she proved to be unmanageable and too erratic to make it work. "I Can Get It For You" wholesale opens on Broadway, and she understudies Barbara Streisand. Still, she comes faithfully to my shows after her final curtain on Broadway. She was always helpful as I moved out of the duplex and over to a coffee house on Bleecker Street called The Bitter End, where under the further encouragement of its great owner, Fred Weintraub, I emerged as the new hot thing. The Bitter End sold coffee, no liquor, and it had the signature brick wall to back the acts. There were mostly folk acts, Lucy and Carly Simon, Jose Feliciano, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and The Tarriers, a folk group that included Marshall Brickman, its bass player, and a hugely funny talent I later collaborated with on a number of films, including Annie Hall in Manhattan. Marshall was authentically funny, and that was a gift hard to come by. Hilda Pollack worked the register and paid me off in cash with a rubber band around it. Adam Perelman worked there, the son of S.J. Perelman. I had many chats with Adam, who eventually committed suicide. I met Bill Cosby when he was just starting out. Dick Cavett tried his hand at stand-up there. And as with everything Cavett attempted, he did it well. My friend Mickey Rose tried being a comic there, but gave it up. But I was a big hit. Arthur Gelb, a journalist from the New York Times, came down and did a flattering piece on me. And on the 6 o'clock news, David Brinkley quoted Gelb's piece and said, "If you go to the Bitter End, you can see a comedian who doesn't mention JFK. At that time, the Kennedys were the nation's most sensational family, and every comic did political jokes. This was the bad part of the Mort Saul legacy. Mort was a genius who did a lot of political humor, which really had not been done as well before, and a million lesser talents figured they could do political humor too. While a few could, most failed. One difference was between a comic choosing the political route and Mort being a genuinely informed, articulate political person. But finally, it was that Mort had a dazzling personality and the others did not. He was gifted hugely as a performer, so much so that other comedians didn't give him credit for performing but said denigratingly, 'He just comes out and talks. Anyone can do that.' So while others might do political jokes, even some very good ones, the audience was locking into Mort's personality. Don't get me started on this again. Topical jokes had the advantage of being news on everyone's mind every day, and the comic starts out ahead by using well-known subjects that almost elicit a laugh the minute you bring up the issue. I always felt Mort was even greater and funnier when he wasn't doing political material. I never, ever did topical jokes, not for any reason. It was just that the subject matter didn't interest me to talk about. To listen to news, yes, but not to talk about in my act. But right after the Times piece, the line started to form at the Bitter End. The shows were packed. Requests for interviews came in. TV shows, like a show called PM East, asked me on, and they did it many times. It was hosted by Mike Wallace, and they paired me for one show with their other favorite upcoming guest, Barbara Streisand. I got an offer to do a record album, and soon I was back headlining at the Blue Angel. In those days, small, smart clubs that catered to sharper patrons had caught on, and the new comics played them all. I played The Hungry Eye in San Francisco, along with Barbara Streisand. I also played Mr. Kelly's in Chicago, where I met Judy Hensky during a period Louise and I were on hiatus from one another. I dated Hedersky and found her to be bright, funny, and charming. She was from Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, which I later made Annie Hall's hometown. Judy towered over me, and we made a silly-looking couple. But it was a treat to spend time with her. The problem was that at that time, no woman I dated had a chance to develop anything serious with me because I loved the Meshuggah whom I couldn't seem to straighten out, nor could I grasp the seriousness of her illness. What the hell did I know from manic depressives? My Uncle Paul saved tinfoil. He peeled it from cigarette packs and rolled it into a larger and larger ball. That was as crazy as I knew. At Mr. Kelly's in Chicago, I also met John and Jean Demanian, and we became great friends. I will tell you the story of me and Jean as I go along, and it is a strange one. I played the Crystal Palace in St. Louis, where an emerging artist, Ernie Trova, showed me his sculptures, which eventually scored big in the pop art world. At the Blue Angel, I appeared with Nina Simone, and working there, I met Patty Chayefsky, Frank Lesser, Billy Rose, Harpo Marx. Of course, they all came in to see Bobby Short in the lounge. But I was a big hit there, and that is where I met Dick Cavett, who was sent to scout me by the TV show he worked on. He became a fan straight away, and we became good friends, hanging out together and pounding the pavement on both coasts, sharing our love of Magic, Groucho, S.J. Perlman, W.C. Fields, and the duck wonton soup at Sam Woe's. Cavett is the kind of guy whose life is one adventure after another. He can go to the corner to buy a newspaper and wind up at a party with Greta Garbo, J.D. Salinger, and Howard Hughes. Okay, I'm exaggerating, but not by much. He is so witty, well-read, and interesting that since he came to New York from Nebraska, he has been a magnet for the great and near-great who relish his company. Just as his fabulous TV talk show stands out as a record of culture with a guest list that includes the Lunts, Katharine Hepburn, Noel Coward, Fellini, Kissinger, Muhammad Ali, Olivier, Judy Garland, Betty Davis, Fred Astaire, Alfred Hitchcock, Gloria Swanson, Ingmar Bergman. His private life has always been an unending series of lunches, dinners, weekends, and conversations with a huge spectrum of luminaries, from hosting Tennessee Williams to riding on police calls with Walter Winchell to trading magic effects with some of history's greatest conjurers. I think back with a pleasant nostalgia when we both had more free time and we could call one another any morning, go for breakfast, take a walk, then maybe go over to Charles Hamilton's to look at rare autographs, and then he would be off to some lunch with some star, Orson Welles or Gore Vidal. When he took me with him to lunch with Groucho, I remember it was thrilling to meet the great comedian whose voice made everything he said sound funny. But I also felt sad, thinking Groucho was exactly like any number of Jewish uncles or relatives I had who cracked jokes or teased at a family wedding or bar mitzvah. The difference was, in Groucho's case, that urge to comment with funny remarks took a quantum leap into comedy genius. Once Cavett and I found ourselves in Los Angeles. He was a writer on the Jerry Lewis Show while I was appearing at the Crescendo. We went to see all the movie star homes like starstruck fans and stood speechless before Jack Benny's house and W.C. Fields' home. During my shows at the Crescendo, Jack Kennedy was murdered. Here is a telling anecdote that demonstrates either my discipline and ambition or my lack of connection with reality. Nights, I did my act for the club on Sunset Boulevard. Mornings, I spent at my portable typewriter writing my first film script, a commission job that turned out to be What's New Pussycat, a dreadful film. But that's coming up. So I'm writing, and the chambermaid says, "President Kennedy's just been shot. They think he's dead." I turn on the TV, and every channel is frantic with the tragedy. I watch for 2 minutes, digest the information, turn off the set, and go right back to work on my screenplay. Nothing distracted me. That night, my show was canceled, and Cavett, Mort Sahl, and I sat around bemoaning the news. Years later, Cavett was stricken with depression. He was home, gripped in the clutches of it, and his TV producer called me and said maybe I could go over and cheer him up. He always lived near me, and I rushed over. He was despondent, filled with irrational fears of going broke or never working anymore. I couldn't do more than keep him company. Neither could Marshall Brickman, who came over and tried to help, but the sickness was much beyond us. It took years of doctors, therapy, medicine, shock treatments, and Dick's sheer intellect before he could overcome it and allow himself to lead a fulfilling and productive life. Even at the height of his mental misery, Cavett retained his social poise and cosmopolitan charm. Gene Demanian and I went up to visit him at Mount Sinai Hospital when he was receiving shock therapy. We wanted to cheer him up and keep him company before we scooted up to Elaine's for dinner. We hoped Dick wouldn't be too down, too wrecked by irrational demons and the prospect of electrical voltage. So we go up there. He's in front of a mirror, dressing in a tux. "I only have a few minutes," he tells us. "I'm meeting Jack Nicholson, and we're going to a dinner party." With that, we exchange a few words, and he exits like Fred Astaire for an exciting evening, and we're left standing in a mental ward. The next day, they'd be putting electrodes on his head, but God forbid he should miss a dinner party with a great star. It seemed like I was surrounded by great and wonderful people, unstable as uranium. Louise would be a delight one moment, and the next, complaining her skin hurt. Her hands are becoming stiff. She can't breathe. She's dying. This episode might be at 3 a.m, waking me up. Now she's off the bed on the floor, hyperventilating, terrified. Suddenly she's gasping for air. What am I supposed to do? In my family, the only distress at 3 a.m. could be cured by a few Tums. It looks like she's having some kind of exotic fit, so I call an ambulance, which drives us to Lenox Hill. She's examined, shot up with some needle, and we're turned out. A cab at 4 a.m, not easy to find. Back to the house. I don't have my jacket, and the key is in it. I thought you had the key. I thought you had it. A cab to the Americana Hotel. By now her sedative has kicked in, and she can't keep awake. I'm navigating her inert body through the lobby while the bellhop shows us to a room. The following day, the locksmith lets us back into the house. The next week, this pretty girl convinces herself irrationally she's too fat. I prove to her with geometric logic that she is not too fat. In fact, not fat in the slightest. But it's to no avail. Crash diets ensue. Clearly unhealthy radical nonsense. Fasting. Only protein for several days. Then only salad. Carbs. Then no carbs. Only liquids. More fasting. Again, the middle of the night, she awakens. "I'm starved," she tells me. No wonder. She goes to the kitchen and opens a half dozen cans of tuna fish. And by a half dozen, I mean 6 cans. She pops the contents into a huge bowl and puts in plenty of mayonnaise. She mixes it all up. Here we go again. It's 3 a.m. and we're both back in our bed sitting up. I'm exhausted and forlorn. She's gorging herself on tuna salad. The next day we sleep in and she's consumed with guilt over breaking her diet, convinced she's gained 5 or 6 pounds overnight. Louise couldn't cook. She could only make spaghetti, and her recipe was for 8 people, which she could not prorate. Hence, the two of us would always be eating spaghetti with 6 portions left over. Soon, she's back on speed again for the latest crash diet. I'm wondering if the few good days per month, which have dwindled down from 5 to 2, are worth it. Then a few days later, the madness subsides, and she's the best female pound for pound in the world. She's sweet, brilliant, very funny, very charming, very sexy. And by sexy, I will give you only one example because it's embarrassing. The tip of the iceberg. We're sitting at a restaurant having placed our orders. I am looking forward to my succulent Nova Scotia appetizer. She is suddenly overcome with lust. I have done nothing to provoke this except to be my usual, loving, amusing, buoyant self. "Come on," she says, rising. "Where?" says I, salivating over the imminent delivery of a plate of lox. "I feel like making love," she says. "But I ordered my appetizer," I complain. "Let's go," she says, wanting what she wants when she wants it. Where, I squeal, being pulled up and dragged to the door. We'll be right back, she tells the waiter. But where are we going, I ask. I saw a little alley around the corner, she says. But we're in Midtown New York, I say. We're on 54th Street between Broadway and 7th. The whole city is out there. It's a tiny dark spot, she says. Down some steps. It's pitch black. No one will see us. Now, being hustled through an ensemble of garbage cans, I am pushed into what is a dark, secluded outdoor spot in Midtown Manhattan. All around us, traffic and pedestrians barely out of sight. Finally, lust trumps locks, and I succumb. We make love, and not too long after, I am sitting over my portion, a beatific smile on my face, her cheeks rubicund with fulfillment. Women like that do not grow on trees. Incidentally, going to restaurants with Louise was always a special trauma, because she'd order, then change her order, then go back to the original order, and I was always the breaker of news to the waiter that the order needed to be switched yet again. I shouldn't have had the waiter debone my fish, she once said to me at Lutèce. Horrified, I asked, you don't want the bones put back? I braced myself. Would I have to make that request? But anything for that woman, because I did love her. And all during this time, I was working as a comedian, developing technically, and my reputation growing. Sometimes Louise would go on the road with me, and sometimes she'd stay home and yank some other guy out of his seat and hop into bed with him. She was supersonically promiscuous, and yet she loved me, and if I ever threatened to break up with her, she got panicky and depressed. She'd make a real effort to be the perfect girlfriend, but she never met a mattress she didn't like and had a cottontail's libido. She was a good influence on me in many ways, and getting me out of my reclusiveness was one of them. She made friends easily. People liked her, her energy and intelligence, her charm and humor. She came with me to Chicago, where I played Mr. Kelly's. She was the one open to the warmth of John and Jean Dominion, and were it not for Louise, I would never have followed up on their overtures of friendship. Their image of Louise is at the Astor Towers Hotel, high above Lakeshore Drive, John and Jean waiting in the suite to take us to dinner, me ready, Louise, late as usual, standing, her head tilted so her long blonde hair could hang down on the ironing board as she ironed it over and over to make sure it was straight. Jean and John eventually divorced but remained close friends their entire lives and both moved to New York. I became close with Jean, and it's not an exaggeration to say that for decades she was the closest person in my life. Jean and I were true friends. We saw one another through good times and bad, held each other's hand through rocky relationships with the other sex. We ate dinner together every night, either the two of us or with other friends or with whoever each of us was dating. She was the last person I spoke to before turning out the lights to go to sleep when I lived alone, and the first I called upon awakening. We walked the streets together, watched a million movies together, traveled in Europe together. For the many years she was with her boyfriend, the man she met while I was in Paris filming in the 1970s, and whom she had stayed with since, the three of us were inseparable. She fixed me up with dates at times. I helped her get work in TV when she moved to the city. We had no secrets. We were closer than family. This extreme and pleasurable closeness continued decade after decade until I sued her. And believe me, I still don't get it. I guess it began when Jean and her wealthy boyfriend decided one day to be producers and started by backing a number of my movies. The films were mostly profitable, and I let my share of the profits stay with them, feeling more secure than if I had put it in a bank. They said I should take my cut as we went along, but I said, I'm not in this for the money. I just like making movies. It was true that I almost never did anything, and certainly nothing I cared about for the money. As Jack Rollins always said, don't choose projects for the money. Choose artistically. Concentrate on doing good work, and the money will come. It was something I didn't need him to tell me, but hearing it from him confirmed my own feelings. And so I gradually accumulated a sizable amount of money from films I did that went into profit. I always took a very meager salary to keep budgets low. I was probably the lowest paid filmmaker of my generation. And I'm getting way ahead of my life story here, but it's the clearest way to explain what I still can't explain. I'm married to Sun Yi. We have a child. I just bought a house because our apartment was too small for a growing family. My business manager, Steve Tannenbaum, says, I'd like you to dip into the pot of your profits a little, as there are some large expenses coming up. Utterly inexplicably, from these two lovely people, Jean and her boyfriend, he gets a small stall. Mindful of a close friendship, he goes about it gingerly over and over, but always gets a little runaround. A year passes with no action. Now, if Jean and her boyfriend had come to me and said, we're short, we have to use the money, bear with us, I would have said, of course, you're my best friends, pay me when you can afford it. But this was not the case. Her boyfriend, a Safra, was a billionaire, and what I was asking for, and which was my hard-earned profit, was chump change to any billionaire. If I was unaware of some financial catastrophe that required the expropriating of my money, all I had to do would be to tell me, and I would have sympathized and been fine helping out. But there was no financial catastrophe, and more time passed amid tactful requests, stalling, and evasion. I would have thought that given my closeness with Jean, she would have said to her boyfriend, I'm dealing with my closest friend. The last thing I want is for an issue of money, which destroys so many relationships, to have the slightest impact on this one. Let's resolve this instantly in the most friendly way. That didn't happen. And despite my pleading to resolve matters, we were finally forced to audit. The audit showed I was owed considerably more than we were asking for. I suggested they give me the smallest sum, and we quickly put this behind us and move on. No response. Still more time passes, and it starts to become apparent they have no intention of giving me anything. It is unfathomable to me, as both are hugely generous, supportive friends. Jean explains that her boyfriend, through whatever tortuous train of thought, does not agree he owes me money. I point out the audit to no avail. I suggest we go no further down a path that can harm a lifelong friendship, and we should simply dump it into the hands of an arbitrator, walk away, and whatever he says, we do. They are willing to arbitrate, but it cannot be binding arbitration, and I am told point blank, if it works out where they have to pay me, they will not be bound to do it. The absurdity of everything is now beginning to become irritating, and I want to preserve the friendship, but I can't figure out where to go with this. I can't afford to just forget the money, as we are talking about millions of fairly earned dollars over a number of years of work. And while I would gladly take a fraction of it just to keep peace, no fraction is on the table. Meanwhile, we all have dinners together like there's no elephant in the room. And for me, there wasn't. I enjoyed their company and never gave a thought to the issue at hand. We didn't discuss it and had many a great time and lots of laughs. Now more time goes by and Jean calls the last minute before our next film together and says they are backing out from sponsoring it. I accept this news and mention that the others already hired might not be so amenable to a sudden last-minute rug being pulled out, and could sue. Uncharacteristically, Jean says, let them sue, it'll cost them and take them forever. This is not her. She is a wonderful, lovely person. What kind of lovely, wonderful person talks like that? As the lawyers say, did there come a time when you decided to sue? Well, yes. I couldn't get to first base on any aspect of the money owed me. When Jackie Safra said he didn't like arbitrators nor trust them, then I suggested we turn to God. I said, find someone you trust, a rabbi maybe. Let him study the matter and come to a decision. Unacceptable, he replied. We owe you nothing. So yes, there came a time when we threatened to sue. Still, they remained unwilling even to settle for a lesser sum. And all the while, Jean and I and Sunyi are having dinner together every night. Others join us. We talk, gossip, laugh. If the subject of our conflict comes up, which it hardly ever does, it gets deflected. Jean's boyfriend is not present at these dinners as he was often in Europe. He was by law permitted only 4 months a year in America, and even a day longer would have meant he would have to pay income tax, and he had a worldwide network set up to efficiently deal with the minor irritant of his fair share. Finally, at Cipriani one evening, Jean and my wife and I sat and ordered and laughed, and I said, "Please, this is the 11th hour. Tomorrow, my lawyer is going to file a suit against your company. Isn't that the dopiest thing you've ever heard? Let's settle this dumb conflict and get on with our lives." Charm from Jean, but no response to my plea. Sunyi and I go home. It's midnight. I call Jean on the phone, and we talk. And I beg, "Please, get a friend we both respect to arbitrate. Get a rabbi. Get someone. Don't let my lawyers serve papers. What good does a lawsuit do? We all lose that way." More charm, wit, but no engagement on the gathering clouds of a showdown in court.
And that's where we will pick up at next week. Now, talk about off track. Now, he's fast forwarded like this is some years down the road. Like, we've traveled like a good 30 years or so. Maybe more than that down the road, if he and Sunyi are married and have a child now, like, woof. What the book is called, Apropos of Nothing. Again, that is basically about nothing. Mm-hmm. The number, 720-716-7300. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61. If you would like to participate, just including quickly, we had a listener last week. They were following along and they said, "Man, when exactly did Woody Allen go to the Sudan to visit the newbie? When did that happen?" And I said, "Oh, no. That's one of these where he got seasick. He said he was on the water and started whining and complaining. And so to play this off, he lies. As opposed to just saying, oh, I'm cowardly, I don't have my sea legs, and, you know, I'm a nincompoop," as he said before. No. This one, he says, "Oh, yeah, I was in Africa, and I was in the Sudan visiting the newbie and got an ear infection. You know, they got all kinds of, you know, diseases and things on the continent." That was last week. Person wrote in, so I just emailed to clear it up and said that just another example of the racism in the text. Let's see. See if folks who dialed in have comments on this portion of the reading. Let's see. Check the switchboard. See, I see Moen Dallas and the other folks spectating, I reckon. I'm not sure, folks, you know, not feeling Mr. Allen's autobiography again. Definitely not on my top 10 book list. But one, well, we haven't even got to the main part. We haven't even got to. Might be one of those we have to be patient because we're still pretty early. But the main part, how exactly did Sunyi get here and all of that, that is still to come. So hang in there. That happens to some books, too. You just have to read a little bit for the introduction and get through the slow parts to get to the goodies. Let's see. Mo and Dallas, any thoughts or not impressed with Mr. Allen this far?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir, Mo and Dallas.
Okay. My thoughts, when he was describing Louise's home, remove my mask. He was describing, I believe it was Louise's home, and he was talking about how elegant her living area was and how filthy her room was. He actually made a joke about the maid not being present or taking a vacation, I believe. And she responded, "Oh, no, this is what it is." And his response to that was sex. This to me, paints him as a filthy person as well. That's just dirty, in my opinion. But to Louise's defense, if ever a white woman needed to be defended, he referred to her as unmanageable, I believe. I think that was her. Because he was trying to, I guess, pimp her out to another white male in some capacity for, I think, a singing career. But understanding his logic and the way that he, understanding what he believes or perceives as normal, I can comfortably conclude, and this is just me personally, that Louise may not have been crazy. She might have been fine, competent, and just uncontrollable, which made her seem crazy. Because if you're surrounded by so much insanity, this man is going to shock therapy and then going to meet with Kevin Hart. You know, what is that? Like, he's in the mental wards. Like, you know, no, that is what does it mean to be white? Now, the nerve of him complaining about a 3 a.m. emergency and how cabs are hard to find and he and his family isn't used to anything beyond acid reflux. He was just the man in the previous audio segment up at 3 every morning throwing up. That should be, like, she might have caught whatever affliction she has from dealing with him for his 3 a.m. routine, if it still was prominent. I thought he mentioned that it took years of therapy to get rid of it. So I would assume that affliction would have remained while he was with his this wife. I don't know which one she is. I wrote DeLorean. 30 years time traveling. He really did just give his daughter his baby. Like that happened. I thought maybe the audio segment skipped or something. I thought I wasn't paying enough attention. I missed an important piece. And I zoned out. But apparently, Gus, you heard it like I heard it. One moment he's talking about some sort of finances he's owed, and the next minute his daughter is grown and she's already had his baby. So, we're very deep into this law issue with these finances. So I'm forecasting, in my opinion, I feel like he's going to try to obfuscate this relationship in some way. I'm the reason, the main focus of why I will continue to participate is because I want to know how he does it. I want to know, like, if I can understand the thoughts that he presents in this book about how he ended up sexually assaulting a person he acquired and raised, I want to know if he can make that palatable. And that's not funny. That is not funny at all. But I'm interested. I'm in my line.
You are interested. That's what that was, the appeal hearing, because I heard the audio of him talking about the relationship, and we got to do this for the book club. My goodness, what is going on? He was so cavalier. That's the only word I keep coming back. He was so cavalier in talking about their tragic arrangement. So, yeah, and he even acknowledges, like, yes, we are time traveling before he goes off on this tangent. He says, and I'm getting way ahead of my life story here, but it's the clearest way to explain what I still can't explain. So he does give you kind of a preface that, yes, we are about to leap way forward in this story. Let's see. Let me go back and get some of my notes. Much obliged. Mo in Dallas, if you think you might have a question or thought, don't wait till the last minute. Let's see. When he's talking about Louise and her being manic, absolutely, he presents so many people that are crazy. He himself and so many other folks. Like, I don't know how you could be a sane person in all of this, and then you have to be in contact with all these folks. Like, Jesus Christ. Even the teacher is racist and taking the students home and mimicking the black. Like, good Lord. Like, what is going on? And he's writing for the monkeys. So he says, Louise has this manic energy, which was so invigorating, especially coming from a bright, funny sex dream. Same thing Moes Dallas is like, how does this... are we talking about someone who has mental health problems? Or are we talking about having sexual intercourse with this person? Like, everything is just constantly... We can't even move to another topic before we got to come back to sex. And sex. And sex. Like, Woody. Where is your mental focus at, Woody? He comes down when he's describing her room. He uses the metaphor. He says one ascends the staircase and comes to Louise's room. One opens the door to it and sees Hiroshima. Now, I am using the hashtag anti-Asian violence for all of the segments of this book club. I was talking about Woody Allen and Sun Yi. That is anti-Asian violence. But I mean, hey, you got the mother of anti-Asian violence right there. And I just thought that was important. Woody Allen is a writer by trade for years. He's written books, screenplays, all of that. He knows the power of words. Hiroshima, like, this is the tacky your use, this metaphor. Like, a white woman's tacky, unkempt room is Hiroshima. Where they've had, like, I don't even know the total amount of deaths from just that one bombing, but then the generations, like, they're still dealing with radioactivity now. And this is just your casual throwaway. The room looked like Hiroshima, my gosh. Mm-hmm. Your World War II metaphors, got it. Anti-Asian violence, again. When he does the whole description of her, exactly what Mo and Dallas said, the hypocrisy, like, are you serious? Like, unfaithful, weren't you dating her when you were married? Self-deprecating, hasn't that been your old book, trying to say that you're ignorant and stupid and dumb? I thought he had the audacity to say that she was dishonest as well. Like, Jesus Christ. Come on, isn't that the snowflake calling the milk white? Let's see. He goes into detail about the New York Times. They come to do this piece on him. I was even truthfully thinking about that the same way when he talked about how he got to meet President Johnson. Like, what makes you worthy of the New York Times coming to do a piece on you about anything? Your writing, your movies? He wasn't a big movie star at this point, but or movie maker at this point. So, I mean, why are they coming to do this big piece on you? It just reminded me, you don't have to be talented to be white. When he was before talking about he was flunking out of school, flunking out of NYU, didn't go to class, none of that. And then he's going to be a musician where he's horrible by his own admission. And he's selling out theaters and all these concert halls. Like, really? What? Same thing with this right here. New York Times, they come and do this big piece on him. After that, of course, shows are packed. Requests for interviews came in, TV shows. Like a show called PM East asked me on, and I did it many times. It was hosted by Mike Wallace, the Mike Wallace, and they paired me for one show with one of their other favorite up-and-coming guests, Barbara Streisand. He's around all these powerful people. What does it mean to be white? I got an offer to do a record album, and I was soon back headlining at the Blue Angel again. Are you serious? No talent, Woody Allen, by his own admission, no talent as a musician, and he's packing halls? Are you serious? In fact, it's not just that he's packing halls. He said, at the Blue Angel, I appeared with Nina Simone, and working there, I met Patty Chayefsky. Oh, and he goes on to name drop some more, but I mean, working with Nina Simone. Imagine that. This is Nina Simone, Hall of Fame, genius musician. Victim of white supremacy, cowbell. I'm here with Woody Allen. Why is he even on the same stage with me? what is he being paid and what am I being paid? It's a whole, disgraceful. That's an understatement, just lack of a better term. It seemed like I was surrounded by great and wonderful people. It seemed like I was surrounded by great and wonderful people, unstable as uranium. Second World War II metaphor, atomic bomb metaphor within the same piece of text, literally pages apart. The worthlessness of non-white life. Let's see. All of this about the being too fat and all the rest of it, I think that's white genetic annihilation. I think Dr. Welsing talks about all of this. In my view, this is right up there with color envy and the rest of it, and having all this neurosis about your body and weight, and then having to gorge yourself and all the rest of it, where you can't even just eat a normal diet, normal healthy foods, fruits and vegetables. It's got to be all these chemicals and diets. And in fact, it sounded so current for this to be 50 years ago, the events that he's talking about, where he says of Louise, she thinks she's too fat, and so crash diets ensue, clearly unhealthy, radical nonsense, fasting, only protein for several days, then only salads, carbs, then no carbs. Isn't that every diet? He hit them all. I thought he was going to say paleo in there for a second, or the Atkins or whatever else, but I mean, he hit them all. System of white supremacy, totally out of balance with everything, nature, eating, everything. He says, so talking about Louise, that she's only in her good mind and healthy two days out of the month. Yikes. Then for a few days later, madness subsides and she's the best female pound for pound in the world. She's sweet, brilliant, very funny, very charming, very sexy. Now, I highlighted very sexy right there. Again, everything comes back to sex. Everything comes up. Woody. And he says, by sexy, I will give only one example. He doesn't give an example of her being brilliant, sweet, funny, charming, just an example of her being sexy, which is the second time he's done that. We had to tell us all the guys who tried to hit on her and thought, oh my gosh, that's the sexiest white woman ever, and rah, 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 all the rest of it. And again, he does the same thing. This one is important because they go out to eat, and the same thing like in the movie, I believe it's Manhattan, where the 17-year-old white lady, female, really teen, is the one who's saying, I want to have sex and I want to do something really deviant, a position you've never done before. And Woody Allen's, what? Really? Oh, my goodness. I don't know. Then in Mighty Aphrodite, Woody Allen is the writer for that film. He writes a female character, white woman, who is a porn star. It's always projecting and putting this sexual deviance off on someone else, on the females. In this anecdote, it's the female, Louise. She wants to go have sex in the middle of New York City. Where? I squeal, squeal. Being pulled up and dragged to the door. Now, look at that. Are you serious? Are you serious, Woody? Woody. This white woman had to drag you out. Like, I don't know. And it's the same thing for men. Really? I don't know. I just ordered my food. And do you think it's... Get out of here, Woody Allen. Come on. He says, we'll be right back. She tells the waiter, but where are we going? I ask. I saw a little alley around the corner. She says, but we're in the middle of... we're in Midtown, New York. I say, we're on 54th between Broadway and 7th. The whole city is out there. It's a tiny, dark spot, she says. Down some steps. It's pitch black. No one will see us. Now, being hustled through an ensemble of garbage cans, I am pushed into what is a dark, secluded outdoor spot in Midtown Manhattan. All around us, traffic and pedestrians barely out of sight. Finally, lust trumps locks and I succumb. Now, even that word, succumb. Are you serious, Woody Allen? I mean, this is a lot of talk about minimizing and self-deprecating. Are you a man, Woody Allen? The woman drags you. I mean, talk about the caveman reversal. It's not the caveman. You go crack her over the head and drag her out to a cave, dark spot. The woman drags you out and you succumb. Woody. All right. And the use of dark repeatedly for Mr. Fuller has kinky in the word guide for a reason, why they use that to describe some sort of deviant sex, and then they say black hair is kinky. Dark, black, all that keeps coming up in here. Dark, black, dark, black, dark, black. For us to go have sex out in the middle of New York City. And that is a part of white culture right there, that flashing and going out to have sex in some public place where people might see you. Big part of white culture. Go in the trash can behind a dumpster. Like, are you serious? Degrading the sex act. Dr. Welsing talked about that. Let's see. And then, come on. This reminds me of White Lies. There's a non-white female who did a documentary film where she talks about her mother, and her white mom had some sort of trashy, talk about sexual deviant, some sort of trashy sexual arrangement with a black male while she was married, and ended up getting pregnant around all this. And so she says that the black male that she was sexually sewering, she says that they had an intensely sexual relationship. I don't even know what that means. But that's in the film, White Lies. That's in the film. That's her language. So Woody Allen, describing Louise, says, sometimes Louise would go on the road with me, and sometimes she'd stay home and yank some other guy out of his seat and hop into bed with him. I thought Woody Allen met her when he was having an affair. He was already married. Did I miss that? Is my memory wrong? He continues, she was supersonically promiscuous. Now I'm sitting here in Seattle, Washington, home of Gary Payton. I know he went to Oakland, but I mean he played here. Sean Kemp. I know about the supersonics, but I mean, she was supersonically promiscuous. I don't even know what that means. Coming from Woody Allen, having the audacity to brand someone as supersonically promiscuous, married to his adopted stepchild. Yeah. Snowflake calling the mayonnaise white. Harry Belafonte was the name I could not think of earlier. Calypso and another black person, I think Woody Allen would have had no problem. Let me hop in the steam room. Deo. Deo, I'm sure they listened to that billions of times. I can only say even the last anecdote where it's we have way deviated, where you shot like 40 years forward and all that, like, these are your white homies. Number one, I've never heard of this arrangement where you're making money and you're just giving it them to hold or whatever. Again, be a man, get a bank account, whatever. Even within all of this, you got white people stealing from other white people where this is not a, oh man, COVID hit. Oh man, my crypto coin took a hit. Oh man, we, you know, the children got medical expenses or something. No, just, you know, eh. Feel like steal a little money this time around. But you got $1 billion. Yeah, but you know. More. Never have enough. You ever going to be satisfied? Nope. Need a little bit more. Matter of fact, need what you got. Give me that too. Yeah. Never have enough. What does it mean to be white? These are your lifelong homies, and they're stealing from you. Chump change, he said. You got $1 billion. I'm not asking for a fortune. You can't even. We got to go to court and arbitrate over all this over pennies. What does it mean to be white, man? If they treat their friends like that, you still kicking it, having dinner together and all this, and I'm not going to pay them. Yeah, I know we've been friends for that, and we're not giving them that money. Like, we're good. What does it mean to be white? I've said that many times. They don't even get along with each other. They don't have all that security and what have you on their houses and businesses for Negroes. I don't think. We got a cheap mention of Bill Cosby in this week, too. Again, now, this book was published in 2020, so maybe it's, I don't want to say a whole lot about Bill Cosby and then to be relating that to me and all the rest of it. But I mean, Bill Cosby is so important right there with Harry Belafonte and Sidney Poitier. These folks were hugely important, would be contemporaries of the time period that he's talking about. And to have no mention of that, you can name drop all of these white men and white women of this time period. But these folks, it's really quick. and no detail to, oh, yeah, the civil rights movement is going on and how these folks are related to all of that and the strides that they're making in television while all of this happening, and maybe a word, a sentence about what you think about all that. Nope. Just back to supersonically promiscuous Louise and sex and sex and sex and sex and sex from Woody Allen. We haven't even got to why we're reading this book yet. Soon Yi and all that. Haven't even got there. Anything else, folks, satisfied before we wrap things up for this time, this Thursday? Sorry. Folks, satisfied? Anything else they need to get in? We will assume folks are good. If you have other comments or thoughts, you can join us next week. We're still pretty early on in the book. We haven't even got an explanation for how Sun Yi arrived and certainly how they did. That's, you know, 20 years even after they got there. Incidentally, I will point out how Sun Yi arrived is connected to anti-Asian violence. That would not be World War II and Hiroshima. That would be Vietnam. So lots of, I'm using the hashtag throughout the text, anti-Asian violence. The kings and queens, white woman, white men. Anywho, we will be here tomorrow, neutralizing workplace racism. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. The vaccine mandates and policies, my goodness, head spinning continues on the plantation. We will try to make sense of it and other issues related to the workplace, certainly racism, white supremacy. Much obliged for the folks tuned in, wrote in, listened in. Hope it was worthy of your Thursday evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We will need high-functioning brain computers to solve this problem. In addition to being sober, if you're going out and about, be alert. I mentioned Jordan Patrick Leahy, that white man. So-called road rage, white terrorist, really threatened a black male, said he wanted to kill 60, 70 black people, Nazi salute in the street. You should be thinking, hey, if a person is being hostile and loud in public, they may be armed. They might have an entire team with them, armed, ready to kill. If you didn't leave your residence prepared to kill and or die, exit. This is not a time for confronting strangers in public. All of that said, if you are going to go out, if you're driving, you are not on the cell phone. We need all of our attention to be mindful about what's happening around us. And we're trying to do the small things to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. No gossiping, no name calling. Very easy ones, high on the 10 stop list. Simple contribution to replacing white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, no brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.